Good morning. Welcome to the House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment on Tuesday, July 29th, 2008. We have one member that we're still waiting for, but hopefully he'll show up sometime during this morning. We have a chock-full agenda, and we are slated to get out of here at 11:45. We have 15 minutes cushion, so hopefully by noon at the latest. We have a lot of updates this morning on many different things that we've worked on, the Conservation Water Supply Plan, SAM recovery, water reuse, Measure 49, a sort of a water theme this morning with some updates on climate change towards the end. So first of all, I'd like to thank everybody for accommodating the fact that the Capitol is still under construction. We apologize about the parking situation. For those of you who have to run out and plug the meters, just feel free to do that. And we will... also,
I'll let you know where my car's parked.
Yeah, I was going to say, Beth, are you willing to?
Yeah.
And if anybody does need quarters, is there a place they can go where I get them? So we apologize about that. Hopefully by next time we'll be back in the Capitol. I am going to ask Beth to provide just a little bit of update on committee schedule, just in case folks have to leave early, and then we'll start off with our update on implementation of measures 3749.
After this meeting, the next committee meeting is going to be on September 26th in Bend. And at this point, that's all we have scheduled. There'll also be a meeting date in October and another one in either late November or early December, and we should have those dates hopefully within the next couple of weeks, but I don't have them now.
And Representative Burley's offered to host a dinner at his house with barbecue and Deschutes Brewery beer. Is that right? Night before for folks to get it. So we'll be sending out details on that. Of course, that's for committee members only. So with that, Director Whitman, thank you for coming this morning. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Chair Dinkfelder and members of the committee. I have with me today two people, Michael Morrissey, who's head of our Measure 49 Development Services Division right here, who's going to help me walk through these presentations, and then also Stephanie Scriffor, who is special counsel to Attorney General Hardy Myers, is with us to talk real briefly about litigation involving Measures 37 and 49. You have half an hour on your schedule for me to do a briefing for the committee on Measure 49 and then also on Big Look Task Force. That's real ambitious, and I'm going to do my best to go through these pretty quickly. So just understand I'm going through at a really high level, particularly on Measure 49 implementation.
And there are several of us that have already seen this presentation because you also gave it in front of the Ag and Natural Resources Committee, but I appreciate you coming in front of my committee as well.
Thank you. All right. First thing is just a very brief reminder on where we've been with Measures 37 and 49. We had Measure 37 passed by the voters in 2004, which gave property owners two options if there were land use regulations that restrict their use of property, either to be paid compensation or to have a waiver. We had approximately 6,500 Measure 37 claims filed with the state by November of 2007, and go to the next slide, Michael, and many of those came in right at the last minute. So in terms of processing of Measure 37 claims, this created some difficulties both for local government and for state government just getting through that wave of claims. Measure 49 was passed by the voters last fall, and essentially what it did, two main things. One, it converted the 6,500 Measure 37 claims in rural areas to a potential authorization for up to as many as 10 homes on the property. There's also a part of Measure 49 that deals with new land use regulations that are adopted either at the local level or at the state level that restrict the residential use of property. I'm going to talk about a little bit at the end of the presentation. Next slide. Okay, so under Measure 49, we had to transition from 37 to 49, and the way that that was done under the ballot measure was by sending notice to the Measure 37 claimants of their rights under Measure 49. That was done last winter. claimants then had a period of time to make an election. There were several pathways under Measure 49 that they could choose. Third step is for DLCD to begin issuing orders, and I believe our first order, preliminary order, is going out the door today, actually, on Measure 49 implementation. Once those orders are issued, claimants then can develop or sell their property. They're given transferability. But in order for that development to actually occur on the property, they still will need to go through a local land use process to divide the property and to get their final authorization for a home. So a little bit about the state review of Measure 49 claims in those authorizations in terms of what we're doing. For those folks who have filed elections, we need to go back and verify that they are, in fact, the owner of the property, what the property is, when they acquired the property. And then the last piece is to determine what they could have done with the property when they acquired it, and specifically with regard to home sites. How many homes could they have put on the property when they acquired it? That core notion, which was in 37, being given a right to do something that you had when you acquired the property, carries forward into 49. That's still the main test for how many homes people are allowed to put on their property. So we're going back and doing what amounts to a historical land use decision to determine what somebody could have been approved for when they acquired the property. That work falls into different time periods. Before 1975, when we had a statewide land use program, the analysis is pretty simple. We're just looking at local zoning, if there was any, and what, to determine what was allowed. In the period between 1975 and what's called acknowledgement, that's when the state signed off on county comprehensive plans as meeting the statewide planning goals, you had a situation where both the local ordinances and the statewide planning goals applied to determine what somebody could have done with their property. So during, for people who acquired during that time period, we need to actually look both at state law and local law. And then post-acknowledgement, we're back looking only at local ordinances. But then in 1993, the legislature enacted a series of laws dealing with farm and forest lands that set standards for land divisions and for homes on property. And so, again, in the post-93 acquisition period, we need to look at both local and state laws. So that's part of why it's taking a while for us to work through these claims that were made under Measure 37 and now 49. Next. A little bit about what we've been doing to make this work more smoothly. We've been meeting regularly with counties. We've organized our staff by region so that they can develop real familiarity with the local codes. We've had quite a bit of assistance, actually, from Oregonians in Action in terms of working with their constituents to make sure that they understand Measure 49 and how it works. We've put out a guide. We have a hotline, a phone hotline, and a website that provides information to claimants. And this number, I think, is low now. It's continuing to go up in terms of number of phone inquiries coming into the department from claimants about how 49 works. Okay, Michael. A little bit of information about what people have been choosing to do under 49. The bulk of the folks under who had 37 claims in have elected to seek 1 to 3 homes in the easier path, where they do not actually have to show, demonstrate through an appraisal that they lost any value in their property as a result of land use regulations. Smaller number have chosen the up to 10 home sites where they do have to come in with appraisal information. And then the vesting category, I'm going to talk about it in a second in more detail. Those are folks who believe they were far enough along under Measure 37 to continue under 37, notwithstanding the passage of 49. And then there are a few claims that have been withdrawn or within cities. Okay, on vesting, we have about 150 cases. These range from single homes that were built before Measure 49 was passed last fall to subdivisions, some of which you've read about in the newspapers, which have been some of which have been controversial, of up to as many as 60 lots. And of those 150 cases, we've got decisions in about 85 of them at this point at the local level through local vesting ordinances. Most of them have been approved as having a vested right to continue under 37, but there is a number. There are a number that have been denied by counties also. DLCD has put out guidance on vesting for claimants and for local governments to use to sort of understand the ground rules there. And we get notice of vesting decisions by local governments. We do keep an eye on them. If there's something that we think is out of line, we'll participate in the local level. But fortunately, we haven't had to do that in too many cases. But there are a few. Next. Finally, just putting 49 in context, a rough number of the likely number of home sites that are going to occur as a result of Measure 49 is about 13,000. That's assuming an average of about two home sites per claim with 6,500 claims. Under current law right now, under farm and forest zoning, we are allowing about 1,000 dwellings on farm and forest land around the state. So this is about a 13-year supply, roughly, of homes that are being authorized under Measure 49 that wouldn't have been authorized under existing law. It is significantly less than the amount of development that could have occurred under 37. We don't really know exactly what that number would have been, but it's substantially larger than 13,000. Clustering, there are provisions under Measure 49 to cluster the development that does occur in order to minimize effect on existing farm and forest operations. There will be likely some water issues with that development, maybe some wastewater issues. And then there will be issues in terms of the interplay of those dwellings and forest operations, probably in particular, to some extent, ag operations also. Those will be dealt with to some extent through the clustering, to some extent through local land use decisions, which people still have to go through, but there will be additional homes out on the landscape under this new law. Last slide on Measure 49 is just a brief note about 49 going forward. 49 does apply to new land use regulations that are adopted by the legislature or by the Land Conservation and Development Commission that regulate residential uses of real property. If you or we do that in a way that reduces property value, we're back under the same ground rules that we were under Measure 37 of either having to pay compensation to those property owners or having to waive those new laws. So that's going to be important to any body that is thinking about adopting new laws regulating residential uses of property going forward. And with that, I guess I'd ask Stephanie to give just a really quick report on 49 and where we are in terms of litigation.
Okay, I know you're short on time, so I'll be very brief. Chair Dean Felder, members of the committee. When Measure 49 passed, we had about 300 cases pending under Measure 37. We have worked to get those cases dismissed, and we are now down to about 40 pending Measure 37 cases and about 10 to 15 still pending in the Court of Appeals. We have about 25 new cases that have been filed since Measure 49 passed, mostly those are cases involving vesting where people claim that they are still entitled
to go forward under their Measure 37 waivers. In terms of costs, our combined Measure 37 and Measure 49 litigation costs are somewhat less than our Measure 37 costs were at the time that Measure 49 passed, about two-thirds to three-quarters, I would say. And of those, the new cases filed since Measure 49 passed are running at about a third the cost of what the Measure 37 litigation was running last year. Of course, we don't know what the Measure 37 costs would have been had Measure 49 not passed.
Madam Chair, unless there are questions, I'll go on to giving you a presentation on the Big Look Task Force and their status.
Let me see if there's any questions on Measure 49 implementation. I see Representative Garrard. Anybody else? Okay. And Representative Beyer.
Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Vesting remains the most controversial part of 49. You have listed here DLCD guidance and limited participation. Could you define what that means?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, in terms of the guidance, this is about an eight-page document that we prepared immediately after passage of Measure 49 that just lays out the state's view on what a common law vested right is and how that fits into Measure 49. I think that's been useful to local governments in terms of helping them understand what is and what isn't vested. We also worked with a number of counties who drafted local vesting ordinances to have a procedure that works at the local government for counties. So that's been part of our participation. By rule, LCDC requires notice of decisions on vested rights to be made to DLCD. So we review those notices. We review the typically a preliminary decision that's made at the county level as to whether somebody has a vested right or not. And if we believe that the decision might be an error, we will typically send in a comment expressing our thoughts about that particular case. We have participated in a few cases in circuit court, maybe a few more than a few. Stephanie, can you give us a rough number on circuit court?
Well, I think we have about 13 circuit court cases. Those are cases where the state's actually been brought into the case by the claimant.
And then there are a few cases that we have filed in the Land Use Board of Appeals. So that's been our participation, pretty much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know I've had a brief conversation with Mr. Morsi on this. I had a constituent who missed the deadline. Of course, they all have reasons why they missed the deadline, but it would appear that maybe a little less than a third of all claims filed never did follow up with the passage of 49. So how many are you getting now that are saying that, oh, we just missed that deadline?
Representative Dingfelder and our Chair Dingfelder and Representative Beyer, two things. When all of the claims or Measure 49 elections were supposed to have been back to us and all of the 90 days had passed, we turned around and mailed out to all the people who appeared to miss that deadline a letter saying, we haven't seen anything. Since then, we've had about 100 calls saying either I never got anything in the first place, or yes, I did send something back, and go look for it again. And we are doing that. Actually, that is a reconsideration process that we've entered into, and in many cases, they're correct. Something was logged incorrectly, or in some cases, one claim would be stapled behind another, and we missed it. And we're going back in all of those cases and correcting paying them and then notifying the claimant if we were wrong, that they're now in the door. There were some people who just flat out missed the deadline for one reason or another. When they sometimes they know that and they call and they say, what should I do? And I say, just send it in anyway. It's better than you've got something on the record than you haven't sent anything in. We'll put them in this pile over here. We're letting various committees of the legislature know kind of how this whole thing is sorting itself out, and inevitably they want to know, well, who can make this right? And I say, well, this is the way the statute was written. We can't do that, but we'll let people know what the situation is. So that's kind of the magnitude of what we're finding.
Okay. Mr. Morrissey, can you just identify yourself for the record and just a reminder to folks, since this is taped and also live on the web?
You bet. Thank you. I'm Michael Morrissey, and I'm manager of the Measure 49 Development Services Division at the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Thank you. And with that, we'll move on to the big look overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the briefing I'm giving you on Big Look Task Force is a version of the briefing that the task force has been giving to a group of stakeholders over the last couple of months. Go ahead, Michael. Just a brief reminder on what the Big Look Task Force is. It was formed in 2005 by the legislature and SB 82 to conduct a comprehensive review of Oregon's land use planning system and make recommendations to the 2009 legislature. So in June and July of this year, the task force has been meeting with stakeholders around the state of Oregon, about 40 different groups, to get input on some very preliminary recommendations that they developed this spring. Next slide. Since that time, they've had additional meetings. Since their stakeholder meetings, they've done some refining of their recommendations. And so what I'm going to talk about today is sort of the latest iteration of their recommendations. But please understand that this is an iterative process. They are getting ready to go out to the public in September of this year and really do the full-scale public engagement. And it's expected that some of these things will drop off, some additional things will come on as we move through this. So right now, their recommendations are focused in four main areas: resource lands, livable communities, citizen participation, and coordination. In the resource land arena, there are a series of main issues that they're focused on. One is how do we do a better job as a state and as local government of protecting lands that are important to the environment? Right now, the focus of resource land protection under the land use program is on preserving farm and forest use of the property. There really isn't an emphasis on natural resource values. Secondly, and this is something that many of you have heard a lot over the years, there's a sense out there, there are many people who believe and who can make the case that their lands were classified for farm or forest use, but they can't make economic use of the property for those purposes. So what to do about that? And then the third issue, if lands are not going to be classified for agricultural forest use and they're going to be reclassified for some other type of rural use, what are we willing to see out there on the rural landscape in terms of uses of that land? Next. So there are three main recommendations coming from the task force right now that they'll be taking out for public engagement in September to get reaction from the broad public. One is to, using up-to-date information, re-examine resource land designations and look really functionally, not just at soil type, at what's important for farm use, what's important for forest use, and then that third category that I talked about, natural resource values, and look at those lands also and determine what lands should be protected for that purpose. Second area of recommendations is to complement our existing regulatory tools with market-based tools. These would be things like purchase or transfer of development rights. This is in part a fairness issue to property owners to provide some market-based incentives to people whose land use is restricted. And then the third broad category of recommendations is with regard to those lands that aren't important for farm or forest use or for natural resources, to allow more flexibility at the local level for determining what uses can occur there, but with some limits to avoid sprawl. Okay. Second area of issues and recommendations, we are projected to have 1.7 million more people by 2040 in the state of Oregon, and the issue is simply, where are those people going to go? How are we going to accommodate them? How are we going to make our urban areas function to absorb that much new population? You've heard, I think, probably in other venues about the infrastructure, transportation challenges of serving that increased population. A lot of that will likely occur through infill, and that presents challenges in urban areas. The existing state land use program largely leaves land use planning within urban areas up to cities, and doesn't do a lot right now to sort of help get us to communities that can absorb that new population. Okay. Recommendations, improve infrastructure financing tools to help make growth possible within existing urban areas. On annexation, this is a controversial area, but it's a limited recommendation they're coming forward. It's only forward-looking, not dealing with areas that are already included within urban growth boundaries, but dealing with new additions to our urban areas to make those additions contingent upon an understanding about who's going to be providing services to those urban areas. To give us some tools in the land use program to make sure that communities don't get out of balance in terms of having too much of an emphasis on either employment or housing, to encourage more regional planning, to maintain the certified industrial site program that the legislature put in place a number of years ago, and to continue to work with communities to reduce vehicle use. That's a tie to climate change as an issue. Next slide. And then last set of recommendations for those of you who do a lot of land use work. We have limited authorization in the Portland metro area to do urban and rural reserve planning. There's a recommendation to expand that to other urban areas. And then work to provide some safe harbors and contingency planning, so essentially ways of streamlining land use planning. Next slide. On citizen participation, this is a tough issue. A lot of folks identify this as an area where the land use program is not working very effectively right now. We haven't had a whole lot in terms of suggestions for how to improve things, but the basic issues seem to come down to complexity. The land use system has gotten so complex that for the average citizen to be able to participate in a land use hearing and understand what's going on has gotten very, very difficult. So trying to resolve some of that and reducing barriers to participation. The recommendations are simplify statutes and rules, encourage mediation, and much more emphasis on ongoing education and outreach so that people can understand what our land use, how our land use system works and why it's there. Next. Strategic planning, this is the fourth area. The main focus here is at the state level, not the local level, and it's really making sure that we have our act together at the state level. We have limited dollars, as you all know, for funding transportation, for funding infrastructure, and for working with communities on land use planning. Simply trying to make sure that the state agencies involved in those arenas are all rowing in the same direction, trying to get to the same thing, and coordinating their work. So that's the fourth area of issues and recommendations. A little bit more on the schedule. I talked about the large-scale public outreach. That's going to be occurring mainly in September, and it's going to consist of regional meetings around the state, 10 regional meetings, also videos that will be hopefully aired on public television and maybe some other outlets. Newspaper inserts in hundreds of thousands of newspapers around the state, and other small group meetings. Next slide. So this is a little bit more about the outreach. There'll also be some survey work that's done in conjunction with this. Next. And the video. Next slide. So the task force will then, after that public engagement process, will again be coming back and refining, revising the recommendations, likely adding some things, dropping others, and is expected to make recommendations to the 2009 legislature at the end of this year. Next slide. So that's a brief snapshot of where Big Look has been and where they're going. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Director. Are there any questions? Representative Cannon.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have two questions. They're separate, but in the interest of time, I'll ask them together and you can address them efficiently. The first is how the potential reclassification of lands will be made, and if DLCD is doing that, are you submitting a budget request in order to help with the workload that will be necessary to do any reclassification? The second question, as we know, there's a connection between land use and global warming, and has the Big Look Task Force considered a recommendation that would explicitly connect the two, for example, helping local communities contribute in a fair way to helping meet the state's goals with respect to greenhouse gas reductions through land use planning?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, good questions. On the reclassification of resource lands, no decision has been made about the process in terms of what the recommendation is going to be. They are teeing up several alternatives to take out to the public and get public reaction to. They'll also be taking that out to stakeholders and getting their reaction. So one option would have essentially a state-led process that would be led by DLCD with active participation from agriculture and forestry. Another alternative would be a primarily local-led process and a local option process with some state sideboards or guidance for how that's done. So those are the two basic alternatives that are being taken out. We have a Big Look Task Force placeholder legislative concept in and a placeholder in the budget also, but at this point there are no specifics in terms of budget requests because we simply don't know. There is going to be a cost associated with this no matter which way it's done. If it's a state-led process, it's likely to be more expensive, but if it's a local-led process, then you're pushing more of those costs onto local government. So more, stay tuned for that. We are working as part of the analysis of these alternatives to put together some initial fiscal estimates of what the cost of the alternatives would be so that you'll have that information. On the global warming, there, in an earlier iteration of the task force recommendations, there was actually a whole body of recommendations on climate change. So what is being done on that is, at this point, they have incorporated some of the specific recommendations back in, mainly to the urban area recommendations that I went over at a very high level this morning. But in addition to that, we have two other bodies that are also working on climate change issues, and the expectation is that those recommendations are essentially being forwarded to those groups to carry forward, and those are the Global Warming Commission, specifically the Land Use and Transportation Subcommittee, and then also the Governor's Transportation Vision Committee and the Environment Subcommittee of that group. So there are going to be recommendations coming from a variety of places here. I think the consensus, we've been participating in all three of those, the consensus seems to be at this point that there should be, in addition to the greenhouse gas reduction goals that are set in statute now, there should be specific targets for transportation and perhaps for a sub-target for land use. There also are going to be recommendations for what the state can do to help local governments on the land use side plan for communities that allow us to reduce vehicle use by having development patterns that allow that, by having alternative modes of transportation that are available and workable, and by doing transportation demand management. So all those things are coming. They may not all come through the Big Look recommendations. but they're coming in some form.
Thanks, Rich.
Okay, other questions? Okay, we have one from Representative Bryce.
Richard, there's some good thoughts about the fact that there's some legislation for the 09 session in regard to TDRs. Do you have an opinion on those?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Garrard, your question is about transferable development rights and their use as a market-based tool, mainly in resource land management. There are a lot of people interested in this subject right now. It's something that a number of other states do to an extent that Oregon hasn't, and probably Oregon hasn't because we haven't really had to because we've had a strong regulatory program. So we are looking, both the Big Look Task Force is looking, and DLCD also has a bill in, and if that makes it through the process, we will be having a pilot program proposal on use of transferable development rights focused on forest lands. Big Look also will have a concept perhaps broader than the department bill, looking at market-based tools. And again, part of the reason for doing this is to provide some market-based incentives for property owners to use lands the way we would like to see them use it, not just use regulation.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I have a last question here about destination resorts. Since we saw legislation last session to amend those statutes, did the Big Look Committee look at our existing statutes, have any recommendations for the legislature?
Chair Dingfelder, the Big Look Committee has had a couple of presentations on destination resort issues back more than a year ago. They have, at this point, do not have a specific recommendation on destination resorts included in the recommendations that they're moving forward with. I will mention again, the department has a bill in that we're developing, still developing, that in essence is in this area of destination resort and would keep some of the key provisions in statute, but essentially give the Land Conservation and Development Commission more flexibility to manage how destination resorts occur in different parts of the state, perhaps tightening up limitations on destination resorts in some parts of the state, and perhaps not doing that in other parts of the state. Right now, we really do have a one-size-fits-all in statute destination resort program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the excellent presentation. I'm sure we'll be asking you to come back probably later this fall for an update. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
And I just want to mention there are seats up front for those of you sitting in the back in the windows if you would like to. Lorna looks really lonely up here. She'd like some company, so feel free. I think Lorna won't bite, but there are lots of seats up front if you'd like to join us. Next, we're going to hear from the Water Resources Department on an update on the Water Conservation and Supply Plan. We'll hear from Director Phil Ward and Brenda Bateman. You do recall, colleagues, that we funded to the tune of $750,000 last session a study that the department is in the midst of, and I asked them to provide us with an update. You'll hear, I think, the department is right in the middle of that study. They've hired a consultant, and so we're going to hear a little bit of an update on that. And I've asked the director to come back, of course, when the final results, and hopefully we'll hear about that before the end of the year. Thanks for coming back. Director Ward and I were on a panel together on Friday, and I sounded like Kermit the Frog, so I'm happy to have my voice back.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Phil Ward with the Department of Water Resources. Glad to be here this morning. Talk a little bit about the project that the chair just mentioned. So there's no signal right there.
Signal detected. You scared away all of my Republican members. I don't know what you did, Director Ward, but
I don't know, Madam Chair. Plus, we scared the projectors.
We have Representative Benz. I shouldn't say that. Thank you for sticking with us.
Be very careful, right?
There it is. It was there.
Perfecting the image. I like that.
There we go. Very good. Again, Madam Chair and members, we're here to talk to you a little bit today about a modest project called the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative. And just wanted to mention a couple of the foundational issues that led us to this project and ultimately, I think, led you all to voting to fund it in 2007. If you were to look at a map of the state in terms of surface water and the allocation of surface water in the state, we've pretty much fully allocated all the surface water in the state during the high use times of the year, so during the summer months. In the winter, there's still surface water available for appropriation in different parts of the state, but during the summer, we've pretty much got it used up, with the exception of a little bit here in the Willamette Valley. We're starting to see our groundwater resource come under fairly significant stress here in the state. Almost hard to believe, but we have parts of the state, some of them right here in the Willamette Valley, where folks are seeing precipitous declines in their irrigation wells, in municipal wells. Certainly the most famous example is the Umatilla Basin, where we have four critical groundwater areas that we've identified currently and have seen groundwater declines of up to 500 feet in some wells in that basin. The Census Bureau tells us we can expect another million people by 2030 here in Oregon. And certainly the projections relative to climate change are, they give you pause when you look at the potential impact on the Cascade snowpack. And so we're looking, all those things combined to say that we need to be paying attention to our water supply in the years ahead. So that led to our commission directing the department to bring forward a proposal for this work, and you all considered that in 2007 and funded it. And again, what we see this as the groundwork for a long-term strategy for meeting Oregon's future water supply needs. This is largely a science exercise. We're collecting data around the state. We hope to forecast water demand statewide with this, identify potential conservation and storage projects, and establish the methodologies and databases to build upon in the future.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman. I'm with the Water Resources Department, and I want to give you a brief overview of the project schedule itself. We are right now, this summer, in the middle of our data collection, or finishing our data collection process. We have both department staff and private contractors who are out gathering data for us, and we expect to have that piece wrapped up in August, late summer. Throughout the fall and into winter, the department will be processing all of that data, doing our quality control checks, and placing the data into an online interface that users can then have access to starting in 2009. And we plan to present all of our results to the legislature in 2009 and again launch into a longer-term water conservation and supply strategy. Wanted to talk through just briefly each of the components of the initiative so that you're familiar with them. The first is an assessment of existing and future water demands. And we've really tackled this in two tiers. The first piece was to take a broad brushstroke, look at a broad brushstroke of what water demand might look like in the future. We've taken already existing reports, projections at the state level, and looked at what our water demand might look like in 2025 and 2050. But then in the second tier, we also ground-truthed some of that broad brushstroke, and we actually did some surveying of some of the large water users, the cities, the irrigation districts, the water districts, to make sure that we were understanding how water is actually used at the local level and understanding some of our assumptions. In the second component, we've taken an inventory of potential opportunities for conservation. And here we allowed survey respondents to actually define for us how they define conservation. There are so many ways to become more efficient and to use water wisely. So we've allowed the different sectors to define that for us. And what we were really looking for in this stage was what has stopped you from moving forward? What are some of the potential barriers? How can we help in the future with institutional and regulatory pieces? So that was component number two. And component number three is data gathering that we're doing in-house with our department staff. We're looking for above and below ground potential water storage sites. And what we're doing there is gathering information, already existing information, from our federal partners, from other state agencies, counties, the private sector. And what we want to do in this phase is really create a clearinghouse so that communities who are interested in water storage don't go out and reinvent the wheel if some of these major studies have already been done in the past. And again, as with the previous two components, we'll put our results up on the website in an interactive map for folks to use. And finally, this is not a data gathering piece, but it is an important piece of our initiative. This is our regional and community-based water supply planning grants that we provided to communities. This past April, we awarded 11 communities with $155,000 total. We required a match from them, and we got a great response. We had project requests totaling more than $600,000, more than we could provide for in this round. And so we hope to do more of this in the future. There seems to be a real need and real interest from communities out there who are engaged in water supply planning. We really benefited throughout this process from a technical peer review group who met with us several times, really helped us refine our methodology, and we also benefited from meeting with stakeholders along the way, too, who had some great ideas to help us shape this project. We plan to meet with this group and stakeholders one more time in August to roll out the results, the initial results of our work under this initiative.
So, Madam Chair, to wrap this up, I just wanted to note an associated piece of work that was part one of the governor's priorities in the 2008 February session and that you all adopted. I wanted to give you a brief look at where we're at on the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Recovery Project. You may remember that you adopted specifically funding for this effort as a part of Senate Bill 1069 in the February session, and we did award a contract to a consortium of Oregon groups that have gone to work in the Umatilla Basin to see if we can effectively do large-scale agricultural recharge in that part of the state. So the concept is, how do we take winter water out of the existing system there and make that a part of the groundwater system in the Umatilla Basin in the years ahead? That project is well underway now. We had great cooperation from the Department of Administrative Services and got a contract out in April, so they were actually able to begin applying water to some sites this spring. And we've moved forward on this and should have the project will not be fully completed until the end of the biennium, but we will have some results to share with you all during the next session to let you know what we think ultimately can be done in that area. So with that, Madam Chair, we'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions for the department? I have one. You can't get off that easy. At some point, we talked about including a component for incentives in the conservation water supply plan. Is that, I know that we'd limited, funding. So is that something that the department is looking into on their own? I mean, one component that I think is really important, and we've talked about this before, Brenda, is looking at economic incentives or some other incentives for increasing efficiencies, whether it's irrigation or at the municipal level or industrial commercial, and also looking at incentives for reuse conservation programs for communities. So have you had the opportunity to look at that, or is that something the department will have under its work plan for next session?
Madam Chair and members, I think it's definitely our intent to have that as a part of the work plan for the next phase of this process, where we actually create that plan, that strategy for long-term water supply. And so I think certainly the department believes that incentives have to be a piece of the equation in terms of moving ahead in the conservation area, reuse area especially. So we would intend to have a very deliberate dialogue with folks on that issue in the next phase and incorporate that in the long-term plan.
And just to follow up on that, of course, I mean, coming up on the 100th anniversary of our water code, I think it's important to look at what are the barriers in existing statute and administrative rule that we may need to go back and revisit, because certainly things have changed a lot in 100 years, and we have projects that are being proposed that nobody ever thought about, and certainly we want to make sure that if there's barriers to moving those forward, we can figure out how to maybe amend existing statutes or make sure that we can work through that permitting process. So certainly look forward to hearing about that. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Beyer and then Representative Benz. Go ahead, Representative Beyer.
I guess having, and I haven't spent near the time dealing with water issues as some of these people on the committee, yeah. But we sat through a lot of presentations on water supply and demand, and I guess my question is, are we looking at new data, or are we just updating old data?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there definitely is both in the mix here. And certainly we don't, and we haven't asked our contractors to reinvent the wheel. And so where there's existing data in place, we definitely have used that. Do you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think an important piece of this initiative is looking at trends and understanding assumptions. So we have looked closely at historic data, and obviously the nature of forecasting will be some projections based on the best knowledge that we have available. And so that's where a mix of looking at existing reports, but also talking to communities who have been doing some of this thinking and planning already themselves, has been very important to our project.
Just to follow up on the representative's excellent question, I think part of the challenge that the department has is to look at where the data gaps are, because what you're going to find out, obviously, I mean, you're not going out and doing new projections, correct?
We're definitely going to have projections in place, but
you're utilizing existing information.
Yes.
So part of it is when you review those assumptions, if there are assumptions you think that, basically have changed, the landscape has changed because of growth, because of changes in demand. The other is that hopefully through this exercise we'll get a better sense statewide of where those data gaps are. And then, we want to hear from you next session is here's where, here's the information we have, here's where we found the gaps. We're going to need to do some existing studies or additional analysis, additional studies to fill those data gaps. And I think that's where I think Representative Spire's question is getting at, and certainly that's something we're interested in seeing. I mean, I understand you have limited resources, that you had asked for more, that, we came back and said, here's what you have, and you can only do what you can with the resources we gave you, but I think it would be beneficial for us to hear, okay, this is what we found out, here's the data gaps, and we're going to need this additional resources to fill that in. And I think that's the type of information we're looking for. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Chair Dinkelder, and thank you for inviting me to join you this morning.
Thanks for coming all the way from Ontario.
All the way. Director Ward, the reference that Chair Dinkelder made to the identification of barriers is of interest to me, but who is the private contractor that you've retained to assist you in identifying those barriers? Because I don't see their name here.
In the Water Supply and Conservation Initiative, the lead contractor is HDR Engineering, and they've been our lead contractor on this entire effort.
Who? A follow-up question.
Follow-up.
Who are they? I mean, that's a name, but I'm just curious about their. This to me is the most interesting piece of what you're about, identifying the problems you're going to have in trying to conserve. So who's helping you do that would be of interest. So I'm just wondering about their background, their ability.
If you can, I'll tell you what, because we're running short on time, Brenda, if you can follow up with Representative Benz afterwards, get him some more information on that and possibly some context, I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions on this end? Okay.
Thank you
so much. Look forward to hearing from you again at our next committee meeting. Okay. As you can tell, we've got a water theme going here this morning, and we had ordered rain just to make sure that we were keeping in close contact here with the precipitation. So next up is salmon recovery plans. Sue Knapp from the Governor's Natural Resource Office is going to provide us with a brief update, and then we're going to hear on water reuse and gray water. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming today.
It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Madam Chair, representatives of the committee, for the record, my name is Suzanne Knapp. I'm with the Governor's Natural Resources Office, and this morning it is my pleasure to give you an overview of an effort that the state has been involved in for the last 2 to 3 years in developing salmon recovery plans for listed salmon and steelhead species in the state of Oregon. You are receiving two handouts. One is the PowerPoint presentation, which you're just receiving hard copy of. I will not have it on the screen. And the other is an invitation to a tour that we are putting together this summer, and I'll talk about that later at the end of my presentation. So I wanted to give you a brief overview of what we're doing, what the plans are all about, why the species are listed, what can be done about it, and talk about some of the challenges we face, but also the opportunities we have to recover these species. Your second slide is a map of the domains of the listed salmon and steelhead species in the Pacific Northwest. I wanted to draw your attention to those that are in the state of Oregon that Oregon is working on. Primarily over in Northeast Oregon, we have the Northeast Oregon Snake River Recovery Plan. This is being developed by NOAA Fisheries. The Mid-Columbia River Recovery Plan is being developed by ODF&W, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The Lower Columbia River Recovery Plan being developed by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Upper Willamette Recovery Plan. And Southern Oregon, Northern California, not shown on your map, also developed by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. They have taken a lead role in putting these plans together, and it has been a gargantuan task to do that. These species that are indicated on your map encompass summer steelhead, winter steelhead, fall chinook, chum, spring chinook, summer chinook, coho, salmon throughout the state. They were mostly listed in the 1990s, primarily because of these three or five threats: habitat alteration, exploitation, overexploitation in fisheries, hydropower effects, hatchery effects, and inadequate regulatory and restoration programs. Next slide. A little bit about recovery plan basics. These plans are required by NOAA Fisheries because these species were listed under the ESA. They are also part of Oregon's native fish conservation policy. These recovery plans will serve as conservation plans for that policy. Recovery plans are not regulatory documents. They're guidance documents. They address the four H's that we are, the salmon are facing: hatchery, hydro, harvest, and habitat issues. And they cover from cradle to grave the full life cycle of the salmon. The plans set priorities and goals for achieving delisting of salmon and steelhead. They develop and identify specified actions in order to meet that delisting criteria. And as I said, they create a realistic roadmap for recovery. They are scientifically and technically sound. They involve a broad suite of stakeholders in the development of these plans. That's one of Oregon's key approaches is to be very deliberative in the development of recovery plans by involving many stakeholders, interest groups that we need to support these plans and that would be affected by them, as well as federal, state agencies, and tribes. And the governor's office is also involved. As I mentioned, these plans are developed by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, except for the Northeast Oregon Snake River Plan, which is being developed by NOAA Fisheries. And I might add that NOAA Fisheries is a key partner in the development of these plans, the Northwest region for most of the plans, and then the Southwest region for the Southern Oregon, Northern California Coast Coho Plan. Next slide, what's in a recovery plan? Basically, it outlines four key areas. How are the salmon doing now? What is their status? And as you will see in that little caricature, many of these species are at high risk of extinction. That we've entered into a crisis phase, particularly for spring Chinook. And so our goal is to bring them up to where they are low risk or very low risk of extinction. So basically, where do we want them to be? We want them to be viable to where they no longer need the protections of ESA coverage. We also have, Oregon has a broad sense recovery goal, and that is a higher bar above a delisting goal. It's a bar that achieves salmon populations that could provide and would provide for cultural, social, economic, and ecological benefits in addition to just being recovered. So our strategies to achieve recovery are basically to look at the threats and the limiting factors that have caused their demise, to assess the gaps between where they are and where we want them to be, their desired status, develop strategies and actions to get us there, estimate the time and cost in order to implement those strategies and actions, and implement research monitoring and evaluation and an adaptive management strategy to change course as we move along. Next page. Key threats are listed on this page, and there are many. Threats will vary by the domain that we are working within. For the Willamette ESU, the hydropower and flood control dams are the key threat for spring Chinook and winter steelhead. Land management is a key threat for all domains. This pertains to agricultural timber harvest and development, urban growth, and it's those practices that are detrimental that we're targeting, not just all land management practices. Estuary management, a lot of changes have taken place in the estuary in the plume that affect salmon, all species that enter into the estuary as they begin their ocean phase of life. Harvest management, there has been over-exploitation of fisheries, and that is something that needs to be managed. Hatchery management, there are impacts to wild fish from hatcheries, primarily genetic impacts, disease, predation, competition. Legacy effects are those effects that that still remain and affect salmon in the current state of affairs that took place 100 years ago, mining, timber harvest, we are still dealing with those legacy effects. And last but not least is predation from avian mammalian and fish predators. These key threats cause limiting factors for salmon survival that limit their productivity and viability. Here's just a list of a few primarily habitat-related limiting factors, degraded floodplain connectivity and degraded stream channel structure or complexity. Most streams have now been simplified, which is detrimental to the salmon life cycle. Degraded riparian areas, altered hydrology, meaning reduced flows and changed timing of flows, degraded water quality, which includes toxics, chemicals, temperature, altered stream routing, meaning no gravel recruitment in some areas, impaired fish passage and access to habitat, primarily from dams and culverts, strain of hatchery fish, concern with interbreeding with wild fish, high impact harvest, and mortality and injury from predation. These are the key limiting factors that all these species of steelhead and salmon face. As I mentioned, these recovery plans address the full life cycle phases of salmon from cradle to grave. They address adult migration as the adults move up into their natal streams to spawn. They will address the spawning environment, the gravel that fish need to spawn in, egg incubation, dissolved oxygen sediment is a key limiting factor in that phase of life, juvenile rearing, stream complexity, food web dynamics, productivity, shading, all important for juvenile rearing, and then juvenile migration, flows, spill, are important. The next slide or page gives you a list of key strategies and actions, and I will not go through them all, but the first eight or so or nine deal with habitat strategies or strategies that we will use to address habitat-limiting factors, and within those strategies, we will employ various suite of actions. Conserving natural ecological processes and protecting high-quality habitat is one of the main strategies, restoring passage and connectivity to habitats, restoring floodplain connectivity, riparian condition, restoring channel structure and complexity, restoring the hydrograph as it needs to be for fish migration and rearing, improving degraded water quality, and so on. The next slide is sort of a flow chart of the adoption process in the overall process for developing and implementing recovery plans. Right now, all plans are going through the development phase. Some are nearing completion more than others. And as I mentioned, we have stakeholder groups that have been part of providing feedback and reviewing these plans. Next, once these plans are completed, they will be submitted to NOAA Fisheries for their review and also placed on the Federal Register for public comment for a period of 60 to 90 days. Since these plans serve the purpose of as a conservation plan for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's Native Fish Conservation Policy, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission will need to approve them as well. And then once they receive final approval, which can take 6 months to a full year, stakeholders, agencies, sovereign tribes will be deeply engaged in implementing these strategies and actions within these plans and implementing the monitoring and research that are a part of them. The next page gives you a schedule for where we're at in developing these plans. The Mid-Columbia Summer Steelhead Plan is the first one that's going to be out of the gate. We're hoping for a Federal Register notice this fall and late September, at which time the public will have an opportunity to provide comment. The Snake River Plan, as I mentioned, is being developed by NOAA Fisheries. That should also be on the Federal Register either late this fall or early next year. Lower Columbia Upper Willamette in 2009, hope to be completed. Southern Oregon, Northern California for Coast Coho, we're just getting started on that one. Coast Coho, as you know, were recently listed this spring, and so the state of Oregon is in discussions with NOAA Fisheries on how we are going to proceed with developing a recovery plan for that species. Next page, supporting programs and processes. There's a number of programs in place already on the ground, actions taking place, programs taking place that will support recovery plans. And I want to highlight those that the state is involved in. Certainly the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds forms the foundation for these recovery plans and the many actions being implemented by watershed councils and other partners across the state. The coordinated actions of state agencies is also very important to implementing the Oregon Plan. The Willamette River Legacy is focused on habitat restoration within the Willamette River and water quality. That will be important for the Upper Willamette Recovery Plan. The Willamette Biop, just recently released by NOAA Fisheries, is also a critical component for the Upper Willamette Recovery Plan. It will be the vehicle for much action that will be targeted towards the hydropower dams, providing access for fish and passage perhaps for fish, better handling facilities for adult fish as well. So that's a key program. The FCRPS biop for the Columbia River, many fish travel down the Columbia River, particularly the Snake River stocks. That is an important key to to salmon survival. USV Oregon is a harvest component program with the tribes. Estuary module is developed by NOAA Fisheries. It contains many actions for improving estuary habitat. There are a number of federal lands programs that link into recovery plans that will affect riparian condition and water quality. And the Corps of Engineers also has a number of programs within the Lower Columbia River and the Willamette and in the Upper Columbia River that are important to salmon and steelhead species. And also these programs, a number of them require state match dollars in order to implement. Last but not least is the BPA-funded Northwest Power Conservation Council's Fish and Wildlife Program that has many, many projects funded by BPA to restore fish and wildlife populations in their habitat. Last slide, future directions and challenges. These plans are not short-term. They are very long-term. We recognize that it'll take 50 or more years to achieve recovery of these species of fish. Given that, these plans will receive periodic reviews and updates as we move forward, tweaking, understanding where we need to go. Maybe some new limiting factors might arise, so these plans will need to be reviewed. They'll provide guidance for federal, state, local, tribal, private efforts and actions. They'll be the basis for funding requests, the basis for perhaps some legislative concepts that might come about. And they also provide guidance for what research and monitoring will be needed to track the progress of these fish populations through time in order to change course if necessary. Some of the challenges we face, we already have a daunting task ahead of us with these listed species, but we're also faced with the challenge of climate change and how that affects the hydrology of the basins where these species reside. Urban growth and development, primarily in the Upper Willamette and the Willamette Basin, is a huge challenge to address. Funding, many of these plans, all of them, will require a considerable amount of funding. That's why it's so important to have partnerships in order to implement them, but there's definitely a need for additional state funding to assist with these implementing these plans. And last but not least, we need society to support our efforts and recovery plans, because we'll need citizens in the state of Oregon to implement many of the actions that these plans contain. That is the end of my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Before I go there, I just wanted to touch on the tour agenda. We are putting together a tour in the McKenzie River Basin for congressional members and staff, as well as legislative members and staff, to touch on some of the key issues that we face in the Willamette Basin for listed species. We'll be traveling up to Cougar Dam, looking at the water temperature control tower, and traveling all the way down and looking at habitat projects in the lower reach. So I do encourage your participation in that tour. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Knapp, for this excellent update. Questions? Representative Burley and Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Suzanne, thank you very much for your presentation today. Just a couple of, if I may, a couple mm-hmm. of questions. These recovery plans are all required under the Federal Endangered Species Act.
Correct.
And is this the first time that such plans are being developed for these recovery?
Yes, he is.
Well, the term I think that you used was recovery domain, because you're grouping these species in each one of these watersheds, if you will. Is this the first time these plans are being developed?
Yes, this is the first time. They were listed in the 1990s, many of them in 1999, so these are the first plans to be developed, yes.
Well, some of them actually were 1991, if I remember, the Upper Snake River, Sockeye, and Chinook. You listed under the key threats things such as land management and legacy, and I guess one of the things I'm not quite clear on is under the Federal Endangered Species Act, there's an entirely different set of requirements for federal lands and non-federal lands. Federal lands are required to provide for the recovery of the species, whereas non-federal lands merely need to provide for take avoidance. It's an entirely different set of standards. So I'm trying to understand, are we developing a federal recovery plan that applies to federal land management and federal land activities, or are we developing something that's going to be a regulatory tool at the state level for non-federal ownerships, including private lands?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, very good question. These recovery plans are non-regulatory for the private citizens, for the citizens of Oregon. There are many state regulations that still pertain, like the Forest Practices Act, but these are non-regulatory plans for non-federal lands.
One last question.
Last question. Follow-up.
On your one slide where it says what is in a recovery plan, one of the issues that we repeatedly have with these, you state, you know, how do we know when the salmon are okay, and the research, monitoring, and evaluation. But really the real question is, are these plans going to specify a number? Is there going to be a number of fish in there that once we hit that, we can say we've at least reached this point of recovery and we can consider delisting? Because we didn't see that with the spotted owl. I don't think we've seen that with the marbled murrelet. I believe we have that with the gray wolf. So my question is, what are we going to do in these plans relative to the fish species?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, another good question. Yes, there are abundance targets for these populations, not only abundance targets but productivity targets. We're also looking at other biological criteria such as spatial structure and diversity, but there will be abundance targets.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cannon.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It's nice to have your presentation on the backs of the presentation from Water Resources Department. One thing that comes up in their written testimony that we didn't discuss, I think, in their presentation was the unfunded component related to basin yield and peak flow analysis. My question is whether you have the data, or ODF&W has the data, to come up with recovery plans that work. I mean, do we know, for instance, peak flow has a lot to do with fish recovery. Do we know what will be running in our basins in a way that will be helpful when it comes to developing these recovery plans?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, many things we do not know. That's why there is a need for the work that Water Resources Department is proposing to assess what the basin yield is, to assess how flows change over time. And there is going to be a great need for other types of research monitoring and evaluation to address those critical uncertainties, things that we do not know.
Thank you. And just a follow-up to that excellent question, Representative Cannon, that's one of the data gaps that we need to fill, is what the environmental requirements are, what the in-stream needs are for salmon recovery in many of these listed basins. Certainly, I think that's something that the department needs to work with ODF&W in the future, certainly along with your efforts. If you could, just for the committee, explain very briefly, and then we'll need to move on to the next presentation, how habitat conservation plans fit in to the recovery planning process for folks who aren't familiar with that, because I often get asked that question.
Madam Chair, representatives of the committee, habitat conservation plans are plans that are developed under federal guidance, usually NOAA Fisheries, but also Fish and Wildlife Service, that are plans that private citizens can use if they abide by the programs and the activities within those plans, in the actions that they undertake on lands, that they will be covered for take of listed species. So habitat conservation plans are a way to provide ESA assurances to landowners.
Thank you. Follow up?
Madam Chair, I would offer on September 26th
the next committee meeting,
we have a presentation on that, because we have reintroduced steelhead and I believe chinook now in the upper Deschutes above Lake Billy Chinook, and we're in the process, or the region's in the process of developing an HCP right now, so I'd be happy to set that up if you'd be interested in hearing more about that.
Okay, thank you. I think that's a good suggestion. Thank you very
thank
much,
you.
Ms. Knapp. Appreciate the update, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again in the next committee meeting or two. So we're running a little behind schedule. We'll try to make up the time here. Next, we're going to hear on water reuse from Judy Johnville with the Department of Environmental Quality. committee members, just a little bit of background. For those of you who are fairly new to this issue, I introduced a bill in 2002, set up a water reuse task force, and Judy had the good fortune of having to implement and help staff that task force. Part of what the task force was set up to do, and I don't even remember the bill number, it was so long ago, but was to look at the barriers, institutional and statutory barriers to water reuse. Committee met for a year, came up with recommendations. These recommendations were picked up by DEQ, and Judy Jondal was, I think you've been working on those rules for what, 4 years?
Two.
Yes. We had another staff person who she inherited from, but it's been about a four-year process at the Department of Environmental Quality, and the good news is they were adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission last April. Is that right?
That's correct.
But the moral of the story is that it takes time, and a lot of thought and deliberation went into this process, but the good news is that we were able to revise those rules and move forward in a positive way. We had some excellent input, and I want to thank many of folks in this room are stakeholders in that process. I want to thank you for donating hours and hours of time, but we still have some work ahead of us, and that's what we'll hear from in the panels following Judy. So thank you for being here, providing an overview and update.
Sure, thank you. Good morning, Chair Dingfelder and representatives of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Jondal, and I work in the Water Quality Division at DEQ. I manage the Community and Program Assistance section in the Water Quality Program. As Representative Dingfelder, Chair Dingfelder, explained, I'm here to provide you an update on our rulemaking process that specifically focused on encouraging the use of recycled water from municipal wastewater treatment facilities. As was previously mentioned in the presentation by Water Resources Department, the state is looking at our water resources in terms of conservation and reuse more and more as we face population growth and economic development. And there is also a continued interest in water conservation throughout the state. The term recycled water, also referred to as reclaimed water, is tied to state statute. And this means that this is effluent that's discharged from municipal wastewater treatment facilities only, and it is used for a specific beneficial purpose after the water has gone through a treatment process. It may not be used for drinking water purposes, as outlined in our rules. A municipal facility is also referred to as a wastewater treatment facility. These facilities primarily treat human water-carried human waste, which in our world we know as sewage. Since this water is from wastewater treatment facilities, it is regulated by DEQ under our water quality permitting program, and therefore the recycled water program also is regulated by the department. As a little bit of background, as Chair Dingfelder had mentioned, in the 2003 legislative session, Senate Bill 820 required the department to form this urban reuse task force, which looked at opportunities and barriers. One of the recommendations from that task force in their final report was to streamline regulations, and therefore the DEQ embarked on a rulemaking process that took about approximately 3 years to complete. Another important policy was developed through the governor's executive order that was signed in March of 2005 that stated that water reuse should be an integral component of economic development, water conservation, and environmental sustainability in the state. DEQ continues to work with five other state agencies that are identified in a memorandum of understanding that was developed under the executive order, that really the bottom line is to ensure state agency coordination on all water reuse issues. Last April, I provided information about DEQ's water reuse program to the House Committee on Energy and Environment. At that time, we were in the process of revising our rules, and as Chair Dingfelder mentioned, they were adopted this April by our Environmental Quality Commission. The rulemaking process included the water reuse task force that represented various stakeholders throughout the state, and we also had a public comment period during which we had received numerous comments, most of which were in broad support for revising our rules.
briefly, I'll touch upon the recycled water use rules and what the highlights of the rules are and the changes that were made that we feel that did address the intent of the rulemaking process. The first was to remove potential regulatory barriers in language that unduly stigmatizes recycled water. The task force believed that there was a lot of language and verbiage and rules that people weren't understanding, and we wanted to also align our rules with what other states in the Northwest and the West were doing with recycled water. So we feel that now that the rules were reorganized, rewritten somewhat, that it is a lot easier just for a person to pick up our rules and look at what is required for the treatment and use of recycled water. The second issue is that the old rules were more focused on recycled water for irrigation purposes. There are approximately about 98% of the projects in the state that do use wastewater, recycled water for irrigation purposes. So the new rules, we wanted to include more beneficial purposes that would promote use for commercial or industrial end uses. The rules continue to allow DEQ to authorize other end uses, and in doing so, we will confer with the Department of Human Services. Another issue was there was the old rules addressed the need for a contract between a wastewater treatment facility and the end user. Many facilities felt this was an obstacle for them to engage in water reuse on large irrigation projects in particular. The department, we conferred with our council, and the ambiguity of contracts in the rules was removed, and now the new rules state that it is clear as to who should comply, and basically anybody that has control over the treatment, the use, or distribution of recycled water is liable to comply with our rules. The new rules also allow for use of up-to-date treatment technology. Alternative treatment technologies may also be approved by DEQ, and in doing so, we will look at what the specific use of recycled water is intended for. A recycled water use plan is currently required to be implemented and approved by the DEQ before using any recycled water. The new rules clarify what is required specifically in a plan, and the rules specify who we should confer with in terms of the Department of Human Services for review of those plans, and also in some cases we need to consult the Water Resources Department. During our Environmental Quality Commission meeting for adoption of the rules, there was discussion and interest from some of our commissioners regarding the use of recycled water for wetlands, the direct injection of recycled water into aquifers for storage and recovery, and gray water. I will summarize a bit about these issues and will clarify just exactly what the commissioners' concerns were. First, the rules now clarify that wetlands are included in the definition for waters of the state. That's state statute. It wasn't always clear as to when wetlands could or could not be used for the use of recycled water. Wetlands may be used for discharge of recycled water and may be done so under a NPDES water quality permit. Wetlands constructed for the purposes of treatment of recycled water are exempt from our rules, and that's clearly stated now in the rules. The second issue that the commissioners talked about quite extensively was the state statute definition of sewage and the barrier that exists with that statute that we implemented in our underground injection control rules that states that wastewater may not be directly injected into a drinking underground source of drinking water. Under state statute, all groundwater must be protected for existing and future beneficial uses, and therefore drinking water must be protected. The new rules do allow for artificial groundwater recharge, though not by direct injection, and in doing so, this must be done in accordance with the groundwater rules. The third topic was gray water. This topic was not included in this rulemaking due to the scope of the issue, although it was identified by the task force back in 2004. There are multiple state statutes, other state and local agency regulations that govern gray water, and it was just felt that that was too big of a topic to partake and discuss during this rulemaking.
Judy, can you just, for the committee, clarify the difference between recycled water and gray water?
Gray water is household sewage other than human waste, such as laundry room, sink discharge, kitchen waste, water, bathroom wastewater from the sink or the shower. So it's non-human wastewater basically coming from the house. So DEQ had determined that further evaluation was needed of the benefits and potential human health risk with gray water reuse through policy and technical work. As you will hear during the next presentation, and I will not elaborate on this too much, the DEQ staff is currently reviewing how state statutes regulate gray water with regards to residential and commercial use. We have been in discussion with the state building codes, Department of Human Health Services, local building codes departments, interest groups, and the governor's office regarding how the issues of gray water can be resolved. A little bit about the implementation of the rules. We are in the process of developing general program guidance that will provide guidance to DEQ staff and the regulated community in terms of what our expectations are in implementing these rules. This document was projected to be developed and completed by April of next year. This was also under the governor's executive order that we develop program guidance. So what's ahead? DEQ continues to address some of the recommendations from the Senate Bill 820 report. As I mentioned, the guidance is being developed. We will continue to do outreach and education on water reuse through presentations at conferences and association meetings. We are often asked to give presentations. I recently gave a presentation at the Pacific Northwest Section meeting of the American Water Works Association. There is definitely much interest out there, and we do receive many requests to give talks about the state's recycled water program. We will also continue interagency coordination to identify policy and implementation issues that may hinder the use of recycled water. DEQ's strategic directions for 2006 to 2011 also identify the need to promote sustainable practices by encouraging the reuse of wastewater, so it is a priority for our department. Nationally, research continues on such topics as airborne viruses, aerosols that may float through the air during irrigation that some of the potential public concerns may lie with, and we continue to closely follow that research, and we'll work with Department of Human Services as that develops. So to summarize, we believe that our rulemaking effort has addressed the need to look at non-surface water discharge alternatives as an integral part of long-term wastewater management planning in a community. We also believe there is the need to continue to address those issues that were identified during the rulemaking that need further discussion and research, and to continue to work with interested stakeholders to resolve those issues. DEQ will continue to work with communities and public to ensure that recycled water continues to be utilized as a water resource. The new rules and copies of the Environmental Quality Commission staff report for rule adoption are available on our website, and I also would be happy to provide those as needed. I want to thank you for this opportunity to provide the update, and would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Judy, and appreciate all your hard work over the past several years, and I know you continue to work to educate municipalities and folks who are interested in looking at water reuse. Are there any questions for Judy? Just a quick one for you. I always like to let my committee go first and wrap things up. But were there any issues that you felt still needs to be addressed that weren't within the scope of the rulemaking in addition to gray water?
I do not believe so.
Okay. And then finally, as far as we heard this morning from the Water Resources Department about their grant program. So if, for instance, would somebody that's looking at a water reuse project, and we've talked about this, funding is a big issue and finding the funding, because these projects are oftentimes expensive. The technologies are still very expensive compared to traditional treatment. So did you discuss funding options? I know that there's some opportunities in the 1149 funds for grants for water reuse. Have you looked at what the needs are and maybe possible ways to address that?
No, Madam Chair, we have not looked at any funding opportunities or incentives. That's driving municipal facilities out of streams and looking at more sustainable alternatives is driven by our department as well, due to the more stringent standards that they must meet with their discharges. So that is definitely a driver. We are closely involved with Senate Bill 1069 and working with WRD, reviewing the grant applications and participating on the Rules Committee. So we are tied with that process.
Okay. And then finally, as far as you talked about injection, so as far as recharge, aquifer recharge, municipalities would be required to treat to the same level if they were discharging into a stream, if they were going to inject underground?
Madam Chair, if a facility wants to inject into a ground, into the groundwater, as I had mentioned, direct injection is now prohibited under our other rules dealing with UICs. We are looking at changing that, and that would be allowed to allow this practice. Right now, you can recharge an aquifer by indirect means, basically kind of through a subsurface method, and by the time it reaches the aquifer, it must meet drinking water standards. That's the bottom line in the state, since all of our aquifers in the state are deemed as drinking water sources.
So that's a separate process that's going on looking at the UIC
Correct.
Rules. Okay.
Yes.
Well, we may want to have you come back and do an update on that.
All right.
Because that's an area I know of growing interest for municipalities around the state. And we had a bill on UICs last session, and that was part of the discussion around the UIC legislation. Any final questions? Okay. Thanks so much, Judy.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next, we're going to segue into the gray water component. We have two panels that are going to come up and give us an update on what's going on with gray water. Now, you've heard about recycled and reclaimed water, and you can expand your lexicon now with gray water. First panel up, we have Brenna Bell, Jonathan Gray, and Linda Peterson. You're going to have to share a microphone up here, and please come up and then make sure you identify yourself for the record. Okay. Good morning. Welcome to the House. Jonathan, I think we're going to have you go first because you're also a member of the Plumbing Board. Appreciate you being here today. And again, just make sure and identify yourself for the record. And I do want to say that I think we have a number of people here that have been working on their own time to try to resolve the issue around gray water. As you heard, Judy from the DEQ talked about all the work that's been done at DEQ to look at the use of effluent, or that's water coming out of a pipe from wastewater treatment plant. She talked about the part that wasn't covered by the task force, and that's, if you want to think about it, it's what's created inside of the house, everything except what's basically being flushed down the toilet, and that's considered gray water. I know this is a really sexy topic, but it's important to know the distinction. So your group has been looking at how best to address and remove the barriers and promote opportunities for use of gray water. So I appreciate the work you've done and that you're doing, and we're interested to hear, you know, what progress you've made to date and what recommendations you have for this committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is John Gray. I'm a principal at Interface Engineering and vice chair of the State Plumbing Board, and also co-chair of Gray Water Advocacy Committee with Brenna Bell here. And I've been a licensed plumber for almost 29 years, and I've been in engineering for pretty close to 18 years, and have always been concerned about the fact that we use great potable water to flush our toilets and urinals. We have a great resource if we can find a way to reclaim and reuse gray water within buildings and outside of buildings to help supplement our domestic water supplies. Being on the state plumbing board recently, we've been able to, through the alternate method program, we've been able to address some issues as far as rainwater and gray water reuse within your private residence. And we have adopted the standards for the manufacture of these systems, and that guarantee maintenance, guarantees the performance of this equipment, and feel that we need to move forward on other fronts to bring greater gray water reuse within the state. From our research, we found that in some of these, or not some, but in buildings, large commercial buildings, we can see up to an 80% water savings by the reuse of gray water. And this would have a huge impact on our potable water resources. In the state of Oregon, we hear that we have plenty of water, but we found that during the summer months, we're at a deficit. We have to store water, we have to pump wells, and by the reuse of gray water, we would be able to really have less impact on what we're doing to our water systems. And we're looking out 30 and 40 years, 50 years from now for our grandkids, and that have a plan in place and the availability to treat this water and reuse it and to be able to facilitate their lives and potable water in their lives. Our company, Interface, we work worldwide, and I've been involved in projects in China, in the Middle East, in Africa. And more you see this is a commonplace occurrence in projects to where they're looking at reclaiming water. The U.S. military in Iraq, they reclaim water for their and recycle water for their washing of clothes. It's a common event. There's manufactured packaged units that you can install that bring the water up to a level of quality for reuse at a safe environment. I'd like to conclude, because these two ladies have some great information to share also, and I just want to say that as far as the stakeholders goes, it's been great to work with Judy and DEQ, DHS, and we've really all come together. It's been a great experience so far to see everybody come together for a common cause. And this is where we really look forward to providing legislation and help with the writing of that legislation to help with the state and make the state of Oregon a real model for other states.
Great. Thank you, and thanks for your service on the commission, because I know that's an important job, and on the plumbing board, I should say, and that you donate time to do that, so we appreciate that.
Well, we all have a passion.
Okay, Brenna?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me here. My name is Brenna Bell, and I'm the staff attorney with Willamette River Keeper, and I also volunteer with a group called Recode Portland. And beyond those groups, I really feel like I'm here representing a growing community movement who is really interested in how to live more sustainably, and reusing gray water is a key aspect of that. This past April, we organized a meeting that had about 40 people representing city agencies and bureaus and green builders and natural builders and architects and designers and homeowners, all people who are really interested in how they can look at their life cycles and just make them more sustainable. There there's a large barrier in the state of Oregon to doing that, and it's our definition of gray water. Judy Jondal told you that in Oregon, gray water is defined as sewage, other than black waste, such as bathwater, kitchen wastewater, and laundry water. Note the use of the word sewage in there. That's the important sticky point, which I'll get back to. But first, I really want to talk about how we can use gray water and how much of it there is. We've heard a lot today about diminishing water supply and increased projected growth in the state. Well, how much water is available in the reuse of gray water? So using some numbers from Portland, where I live and where most accessible, I can give you an idea of how much water is out there that could be reused, which could also be read as saved, by using gray water. So the average residential use of water is about 68 gallons per person per day in Portland, and about half of that is used for flushing toilets, which means the other half is available for reuse as gray water. So that's about 35 gallons per person, or 85 gallons per household per day. That might not sound like a lot, but looked at collectively, in Portland we have 16 million gallons per day that could be used as, or reused, which means 16 gallons, million gallons per day that don't need to come in to the system. I was thinking about that in terms of volume, and that's enough to fill the state capitol two-thirds full every day. So we're not going to do that.
We just fixed the plumbing there. So we're hoping that doesn't happen.
We're not going to flood you out with our gray water, but just imagine that volume of water. If we're entering a time of increased growth coupled with water scarcity, we need to be identifying new sources of water. And this is 16 million gallons of water just in Portland that we are flushing down the drain every day that we need to find new sources for. So that's how much is there. And how can we use this water? John mentioned one, which is almost a no-brainer, which is using it for the flushing of toilets. And the State Plumbing Board just took action to make that easier in residences, and hopefully we'll be tackling that in commercial uses soon. But there's a whole other aspect, and that's use of gray water for exterior irrigation. And this is where the sticky point is. This is where we need your help. Because currently, as gray water is defined as sewage, it's illegal to dump your sewage on your land. That makes sense. But when, you know, when something is actually not sewage, when it's usable water, we need to look at how we could use it and change the definition of sewage and change the definition of gray water to allow for that. So the opportunity to recognize gray water as a resource rather than a waste and create a regulatory system that allows for maximum use. So I actually think that gray water is a pretty sexy issue. I've been really excited about it. I've spent my entire last year organizing around this after I spent last summer literally hauling buckets of water from my shower to my garden every day and thinking, this makes no sense. And this year I hurt myself, so I can't even do that. So I watched the water go down the drain and then pull the hose out and think, this really makes no sense.
I was going to say, Lorna's behind you looking at that lost revenue, so I don't know if I would advertise that.
There are savings, though. So we've got, there's the water conservation aspect. As I said, you know, or John mentioned, in the summer, our water use doubles at the same time when supply decreases. So now we're looking at, you know, really complicated supply and demand where we have to go. In Portland, we pump from the Columbia well fields every summer to make up for that lost demand. If we could be using our household wastewater as irrigation, that would decrease the amount of water that we need to get from other sources in the summer. And also, as has been mentioned by many people, there's the issue of growth. We really do need to locate new sources of water. Many people have been looking at the Willamette River as a potential source of potable household drinking water, and some people actually are doing it. Now, another aspect of my job, I read DEQ effluent permits and know what goes into the Willamette River. And I don't think it's a good idea that anybody should be drinking that water, and it takes an enormous amount of energy to clean it to the level where it could then be potable. If we can look at existing sources that we already have that we are quite literally wasting and treating it wastewater and making them available to be used as irrigation, we would create a whole new water source without really doing anything except changing a definition and then establishing a rule. And finally, it would have monetary benefits for residential household users, but also for municipalities and water providers who use a lot of energy to get water in the summer months and to clean it to a potable level. So
guess the question is, what do we need from you? And Oregon is one of the last states in the West to adopt gray water reuse laws. California has them. Washington has it. Arizona, my particular favorite. It's great. New Mexico has them. Utah has one. Texas has one. So we have the opportunity to look at all of these laws and pick the best of them and craft something truly unique, you know, kind of in a true Oregon tradition, be resourceful, be independent, and make a great law that allows people to do what many people, I shouldn't out them, but lots of people are already doing this, you know, and we want to make sure they're doing it safely, and many more people want to. And so there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm out there to use water wisely. And it will take action from the legislator to do so. But once it happens, I think we'll catch on very fast. And there's many people in Oregon who see this as kind of a win-win-win scenario. So thank you for your interest in it. And I really hope that next summer we all have, well, maybe in two summers, we all have functioning gray water systems. And I'm happy to answer any questions afterwards.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from Ms. Peterson first, and then we'll take questions the whole panel.
Madam Chair, representatives of the committee, my name is Lisa Pedersen. I'm a project architect for Sarah Architects, and I'm here to talk about the potential we in the architectural community see for reuse of gray water. I want to start with a quote by Benjamin Franklin. When the well is dry, we learn the worth of water. And that's the point where I think we're arriving at here in our sake, even with the abundant rainfall we have. Water was once thought to be readily abundant, but what we found is in the United States, approximately 340 billion gallons of fresh water are being withdrawn every day from rivers, streams, and reservoirs to support the activities of people, often without regard to how the water is being treated and dispersed. That accounts for a quarter of our total supply of renewable fresh water. Green building rating systems such as the LEED system, which is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, have recognized the importance of water conservation and have elevated water efficiency to one of five areas that they look at in terms of green buildings. A decline of the availability of the resource and an increase on its demands for it have resulted in this change of attitude. And although climate conditions dictate which areas experience water shortages first, we saw last year the Southeast was one of the areas hardest hit. The equation, I think, will eventually tip for all of us, except for maybe the most wet, unpopulated areas. And once water's not available, the true precious nature of the resource will be understood, as Benjamin Franklin pointed out. To avoid reaching this tipping point, we are working on creating what we call water-independent buildings. This is a research project that Sarah has undertaken with Interface through a Bullet Grant Foundation. A water-independent building is a building that uses 100% of its water from captured precipitation or reclaimed water that is appropriately purified without the means of chemicals. Unfortunately, achieving water independence is not as easy as it sounds. Through the use of water-saving fixtures, we can generally achieve and do achieve in all of our architectural products water savings of 30 to 40% over the 1992 Water Policy Act. That's a great achievement through the appropriate use of fixtures. We also know and have implemented conservation strategies in terms of how people are using water and have talked about behavioral changes and how we can also save water through behavior. But that's not enough. We also need to employ water reclamation and reuse strategies that are currently not allowed by state statutes, such as Brenna mentioned with the reuse of gray water. John and I are involved in a project with Central City Concern, which is a nonprofit organization in Portland that builds, owns, and operates affordable housing for some of Oregon's lowest income individuals and families. I'll use this particular project as an example because it's one of them that we're looking at how we could achieve a water-independent building. This is a 175-unit housing project, which we've calculated that it would have an annual water usage of 5 million gallons of water per year. The project is going to be a 17-story high-rise in downtown Portland. Based on the roof area of the project, we've calculated that we can capture about 500,000 gallons of water per year, so about one-tenth of what the building would use. In addition, there's another 80%, or about 4 million gallons, that we could reclaim through the use of gray water, capturing it from the sinks, showers, laundry facilities, and turn that water back into the system. We could, as Brenna was mentioning, essentially double our resource or triple our resource of available water and get a lot farther to achieving a water-independent building. But we really need your help to making this a reality. And I think the first step is to change the legal definition of gray water so that it allows us to consider it as a resource. So thank you.
And I'll take questions now. I just want to note that the second panel will hear from the agencies and the regulatory interaction, the discussions that are going on right now. Representative Gorg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brenna, when you were talking about agricultural application, about 3 years ago, down in a little farming community of about 8,000 people south of Klamath Falls called Merrill, we had a very innovative farmer who did exactly what we're talking about. He started putting gray water on his potatoes, and it worked wonderfully until he was ordered to stop by the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Cannon and then Representative Burley.
Yeah, I just want to sort of summarize what I've heard about where we stand with respect to gray water policy and tell me if I'm hearing this correctly. So the action the Plumbing Board has recently taken changed rules to allow for residential use of gray water to flush toilets, but that's it.
Mm-hmm. And rainwater harvesting.
Yeah, we've done rainwater harvesting.
Rainwater harvesting for the same purpose?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can also drink your rainwater.
Okay.
Treatment.
Treatment.
Okay. And so the potential next steps that you're proposing to us would include the statutory change redefining gray water to allow for exterior irrigation, and it sounded also like we might pursue, or the Plumbing Board might pursue, a change to allow for commercial use of gray water in toilets, since that piece was not has not been done yet. Kind of understanding the policy lay of the land. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we'll hear more from the regulatory agencies on those issues, but I wanted to make sure I was capturing the full sense of where you are in terms of what has been done and what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Cannon, for that clarification. And what, you know, my understanding is there's certain things that are done through the Plumbing Board and through DCBS, which we're going to hear from Mark Long here in a minute. Then there's certain things that are in statute that obviously only the legislature can address. And it sounds like you've been doing what you can and will continue to do what you can through the changes in rule and code that need to happen. And obviously there are certain changes that we're going to have to consider. Okay. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I'm trying to figure out why. We've got golf courses that are using level 4 water, so I'm guessing the answer is that that's not by definition considered sewage because it's been treated. So I'm probably answering my own question. But I'm also curious, and I'm sure we'll probably hear this from the next panel, there's got to be a federal nexus involved here, too. Is this something that we as a state have just unilateral authority to deal with?
We're going to hear about that through the Safe Drinking Water Act and obviously the Clean Water Act, and we'll hear from the agencies on that.
Yeah, currently, gray water is included in the on-site sewage treatment rules for DEQ, which it has jurisdiction over.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your hard work in making the trip here today, and appreciate it, and we'll look forward to hearing back from you again soon. Okay, next we're going to hear from the regulatory world. We have Neil Mullane with the Department of Environmental Quality, Gail Shibley with the Office of Environmental Public Health at Department of Human Services, and Mark Long, and actually Andrea Simmons is here also, who's been helping out from building codes. I'm pretty sure I saw Andrea, so I'll have to just pull up another chair. So, Neil, you want to go first since you're ready to go?
Certainly.
Gail, well, why don't we have you in the middle, and then they can pull up another chair there, since you'll be sticking around for the next round as well.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name for the record is Neil Mullane, and I'm the interim administrator for the water program for DEQ. And what is being passed out to you, I'm going to get to in a second, is hopefully a table that helps kind of sort out some of the regulatory control issues that we have with the agencies, and I wanted to go through that with you. But I wanted to start first with just explaining that in terms of whether or not we include gray water as sewage or not, gray water does have contaminants in it, and we're concerned with the pathogens that would be in gray water and also any of the toxic chemicals that are used within the home that get discharged into sinks or bathtubs and that type of thing. So it isn't water that is clean that can just be automatically used. We are concerned with the types of pollutants and the chemicals that are in gray water. If you look at the chart, what I'd like to do is kind of walk through, and this is a work in progress, and I'm going to pass it out to the rest of people here so we're all looking off the same chart. This is a work in progress that we kind of put together as the agencies have been meeting on this issue and trying to talk through what the regulatory components are for each one of the agencies. And this, I will say, is our understanding, that is DEQ's understanding of where we're at right now and what agencies have control of and what regulatory intersects there are. And so I'll start with this by just going down through the single family resident and talking about the use of gray water in terms of toilet and urinal flushing. And as we looked at the regulations, DEQ does not have a regulatory program to deal with the flushing of gray water and use of gray water within a structure that is a residential structure. Our regulations impact this when the gray water goes out of the structure and goes into, say, like a septic tank or a septic system. And therefore, our regulations really control where the water goes outside the structure, and we have under our ORS's specific prohibition of the use of gray water if it doesn't go through a normal septic tank or alternative septic tank or to a municipal sewage treatment plant. So as we get down through this, in my summary, I'll talk about if we're going to actually use gray water from residential systems, we have to kind of deal with that type of prohibition. So currently, if we're using it outside the structure, that is a residential structure, it would have to go through a septic system, the kind of traditional septic system or an alternative system like a sand filter system or go to a city sewer system. Again, if you look down into the single-family resident in terms of irrigation, again, that's where we have, yes, some regulatory responsibility to look at that, and it goes through that on-site system. Now, in terms of commercial and urinal flushing, the change in the regulation here is that in our regulations we have regulations that deal with individual systems or residential systems, and that's under ORS 454.610. And when we're talking about a commercial structure, we move over to 468B050. And within the commercial and industrial sector and establishments, we're required under our statutes to actually issue permits for any treatment systems and treating any type of waste streams. And Brenna was right earlier when she said within that definition, that would be including gray water within that definition of that waste stream. So under our regulations, we're required to actually establish a permit for the use of any waters and identify the treatment system that is necessary. And that includes both internally and externally in the structures in terms of commercial operations. And you heard earlier from Judy in terms of irrigation outside the structure, our current rules in terms of Division 55 would identify the level of treatment necessary in order to use the water outside the structure for irrigation. So if you look at what we have in terms of just real briefly going through the regulations, if we were to use gray water out the structure for individual homes, we'd have to deal with the statutory prohibition currently for DEQ for allowing individual use of gray water outside the structure. In terms of the commercial, we would have to look at what type of permit DEQ would develop for use of water within the structure for flushing, or use of water outside the structure in terms of irrigation outside the commercial operation. And to give you some idea, we have in fact developed that type of permit already for a structure within Portland. We put together the permit in my group in the Northwest region. We put together a permit which actually identifies the treatment levels necessary for use of water within the structure in terms of urinal water and the use of water outside the structure for irrigation around that particular facility. So we have begun to work in this particular area and have, it's a new area for us in terms of putting these types of permits together, but we have begun to work to identify what level of treatment was necessary for use within the structure and what level of treatment was necessary for outside use in irrigation water from that particular individual building. But we didn't at that time differentiate between gray water and black water when we put that permit together. We just put a permit together for all waste within that individual building, and we mixed both gray and black water together. And that building has its own individual treatment system within the basement of the building that treats it to the levels that are necessary. So in summary, I think, you know, we could, in fact, probably sit down and work in the next couple of months to try to sort out whether or not it would be worthwhile to put together an overall, say, general permit for the use of gray water within a structure, whether it's for toilet flushing and that type of thing, and work with building codes to identify the treatment that would be necessary and that they would be willing to put together the standards for within the structures. And we could identify within that permit what those types of treatments would be necessary and issue them to people who want to put those types of treatment devices within a building and use it for urinal flushing. Now, outside the building, again, we would have to look at having a state permit if it doesn't go into any waters of the state. If you're outside a structure, you irrigate with it, and it gets into waters of the state, we have to issue under the Clean Water Act an MPDS permit for that type of activities.
It's clear as mud now, so I'm sure.
Okay.
But and before Gail goes, I just want to say that, you know, certainly want to hear from everybody else, but I think that if every commercial or industrial structure has to require, you know, get a permit, that certainly is going to be a barrier, number one. And number two, so I appreciate your recommendation and certainly hope that that's something we can work together on. The other is looking at separating the gray water from the black water. And certainly I understand, and we want to make sure and protect public health, as we're going to hear from Gail in a minute on that. But certainly I think that's something that we can look at as well, because there are differences between gray water and black water, and we're treating them the same, it sounds like, through that permitting process.
Chair Dean Fowler, the one thing I would say about that is in years past, we have gone through a report where we actually sampled a lot of gray water to look to see what the contaminants were in gray water. And it's surprising that gray water actually has a lot of contaminants in terms of fecal matter. When you compare that to regular black water, they're almost identical in terms of fecal matter and pathogens. So there is a genuine concern in terms of the pollutant levels within that. And we also were picking up, you know, obviously high levels of nutrients, which if we're using it in terms of irrigation, this is a benefit in terms of what we're doing there. But we're also looking at, in terms of the treatment devices, of what we would need to remove in terms of suspended solids so that any systems that we would use in terms of irrigating with it would actually work over long periods of time. And we were surprised at the levels that you had to get down to in order to have those systems work correctly. And so we have some of the background data on gray water and the contaminants that are in it. Of course, that was done many years ago, and it doesn't have information on the emerging contaminants that we're interested in terms of toxics. And we would think it would be really impinging upon us to look at those types of contaminants if we're going to use it outside the structures. And we have looked at some of the requirements from the other states. And, of course, that was an interest and a concern of the other states as to how those particular products would impact, in the irrigation sense, the plants that you're irrigating on. So we would want to be able to examine that also.
Thank you. Gail.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's always a delight. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley, the Administrator of Environmental Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. As Neil's handout shows, if you look at DHS, the Department of Human Services column there, I think it's accurate to say we don't have a dog in this arena, in this pool. At the same time, we take very seriously two distinct but very complementary approaches. One is around administrative oversight and quality assurance under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act and the state safe drinking water statutes. We can go through the specifics, but overall, it's particularly important that we protect community water systems, and consequently, anything that would cross connect or otherwise raise potential for backflow or other kinds of contamination into public water systems, we care a lot about and would take very strong action. Similarly, within drinking water, protecting the sources of drinking water. You know, the old adage of garbage in, garbage out, so to speak, is very true in terms of drinking water, and it just costs an awful lot more, both in terms of society as well as increasing health risks, to begin with raw drinking water that is significantly degraded over purer, more pristine raw water in order to get to finished drinking water. We're very cognizant of the fact that there is no new water. All water is reused, and so consequently, we're only talking about how do we make sure that we protect the water that we're beginning with, the aquifers and the headwaters. So that's from the drinking water side. From there is a completely non-regulatory side that we are very concerned about and interested in and committed to continuing to work together on, and that is environmental exposures, whether on individual basis or population-wide, of all kinds of environmental contaminants, including those associated with water. And I won't go through the whole litany of water-related environmental contaminants from beach water monitoring to blue-green algae and a whole variety of things we get involved with, providing some of the toxicological and epidemiological expertise, both for our sister agencies at the state level to provide to local health departments at the local level, businesses and members of the public, lawmakers and others. So it's with those kind of mutual and complementary hats that I sit here today. We don't have an ORS or an OAR that is on point on this issue, but I appreciate very much the recognition that public health as a system needs to be a part of this discussion. Our drinking water, under statutes, our drinking water program is, in fact, represented on the plumbing board, and so we are consistently and actively engaged around specific plumbing issues, again, to protect the hard wiring, as it were, for drinking water. We are very interested in moving forward in a way that really promotes sustainability, that conserves water, and that protects human health.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Long?
I don't know if there's a handout that we have. Chair?
And I'm going to ask, can you guys sort of tag team, because we're sort of running short on time.
We can hopefully catch you up here real quick.
I can talk about gray water all day, but I know folks have other things they need to do this afternoon.
Got it. For the record, Chair Dingfield and members of the committee, Mark Long, I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes Division. And just a little bit of background about building codes. I'll just spend 60 seconds on this. We adopt statewide codes, whether it's plumbing codes that we're talking about here today or building energy or electric. Boiler, elevator. If you live in it, ride on it, we probably impact you. The codes that we adopt, we preempt local government from adopting other standards. That's an issue that comes up from time. That's a state policy. It's been around since 73. We adopt our codes through seven different boards. You've talked about the plumbing board today. That's just one that we use. When you talk about the issues before us, and I'll get into water reuse, there are several recent good
good things that have occurred at the Building Codes Division around energy efficiency and water reuse, and then we've had some challenges over time. Right now, we've seemed to been breaking the logjam that's occurred. Let me get on point and talk to you about what we've done around water. And the first chart is rainwater harvesting. I think the important thing, you've heard how complex the issue is, and I want to thank the chair and folks at DEQ, Neil and Gail and Dick Peterson there, who have helped us kind of work through these issues over the last, since about February, I think, when I talked to you last, Chair Dingfelder, on these issues. Rainwater harvesting. We now have provisions in Oregon for potable use of rainwater. Let's drink it, okay? In residential and commercial applications, and we have applications for non-potable uses for residential and commercial applications. Most of that's been done over the last 6 months, and Oregon's fairly well far ahead of the other states in dealing with these issues. So from a building codes regulatory perspective, as Gail said, kind of the wiring, if you will, the plumbing components from source to source, we now have good standards and folks can do that, and there aren't a lot of obstacles. When you get to gray water, which is what's on point today, we have been calling it wastewater reuse because of the definition challenges that we have. And again, I encourage folks to think about these issues and break them down by scenarios. When I got exposed to the set of issues around gray water earlier this spring, it was like a logjam. And it's very complex and there's a lot of issues. So we began saying, all right, commercial application, residential application. Are you going to use it to drink? Are you going to use it to do something else with? Are you going to use it inside the building? Are you going to use it outside the building? And when you begin to break those issues down into smaller bite-sized chunks, you're able to move some things forward through the regulatory process. And that's what we've done here in the last 6 months. So here you are with non-potable uses of gray water. You've already talked about it, but in residential, you can take your water from your lavatory, your sink, your shower, your bathtub, and your washing machine and use it to flush your toilet. That's brand new. Signed the approval on that. I think I signed it July 3rd. For the commercial side, you've talked about that. We're moving forward August 18th, I believe, with a proposal to allow the plumbing standards to provide plumbing standards for this type of use. We have not resolved the DEQ and DHS issues yet, but we believe that we will, whether it's through legislation or through rulemaking or through interpretation or through anything else. From a plumbing standpoint, we wanted to make sure that the products and the pipes and materials were ready to go once we resolved the public health concerns. Okay? So that we didn't resolve the public health concerns and then go through this process of how we train the regulators and train our workers to do it and what products to use. So we want to get ahead of the curve, and that's what you'll see. The last thing that I have, and I'll steal a little bit of Andrea's thunder because she was going to talk about this, but to kind of get you back on schedule, are the other issues we're currently under consideration at the Building Codes Division 2 around rainwater and wastewater. And the rainwater side, we did not get authorization for flushing the toilets in apartments or daycare facilities, and we'll bring that back to the plumbing board and get that resolved. On the wastewater, gray water side, you can see here on the residential side, we want to look at multifamily. We want to look at other non-potable uses. There's a lot of interest in taking a very simple thing like your washing machine, your clothes washing, that has a pump on it already, and getting that outside of your building to water your garden. 6 to 8 states already have looked at these issues and have some kind of external use related to a residential application. We think that with some changes and as we analyze these issues, we can at least develop plumbing standards that would provide the right kinds of products, the right kinds of pipe, make sure it's safe. We don't have the cross connections and backflow concerns that Gail talked about. And then the commercial structures, we talked about the flushing toilets, and then there's also a need, an interest to deal with atriums and solariums, kind of internal irrigation to the building, if you will. That raises its own set of issues that we need to navigate our way through, and then the external issues that Neil and everybody's talked about. So that's kind of what's on our plate. Often legislative committees ask, you know, how can I help? Well, in Oregon.
Next question.
Yeah. In Oregon, you have a product approval problem that needs to be resolved. And it's to deal with construction products, whether they're electrical products or plumbing products or boiler products. We have, in my opinion, an outdated process for reviewing products. And we are unfortunately put in a place in Oregon where things can be used internationally, nationally, or in other states, but cannot be used here in Oregon. We need to fix that. And we'll work with our industries to do that. It's going to take a legislative change. We think that the code adoption process that I've kind of talked about here takes too long, and there are too many barriers built into it and the statutes, and we'd like some change and some flexibility on the timing of how we adopt codes and some of the decision-making that's involved in code adoption. And then the last thing is emerging technology. You know, for building codes, when you're not dealing with issues such as this that have a specific public health concern, the construction industry, 6 months is a very long time to take to figure out what the code is, because you build the building and it's up and gone in 6 months, and 2 years is forever. And so for us to take 5, 10, or years longer to look at emerging technology isn't going to work, because the changes in technology are going to happen faster than we're able to keep up with it on the regulatory side. So we looked at this issue in 2005, passed a bill that gave us some flexibility to look at emerging technology, but it was unfortunately limited, and there are a bunch of parameters put on it that narrowed it to just one site. It takes us 6 months to approve something for one site. It's not very doable for the building community. So three issues that I would ask your help on: code adoption process, products in Oregon, and how we recognize emerging or new technologies so that we can get ahead of the curve on these issues for Oregon. With that, I will conclude our remarks and see if there are any questions, and hopefully get you back on schedule.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your leadership. I really appreciate it, Mark and Andrea. And Andrea, I know, has been right there with you as well, and I know that you have seven different commissions that you work with, so this is just one of the many issues you deal with every day. So certainly appreciate the progress you've made since we talked in the special session, and I know you'll continue to make progress working with the two folks sitting next to you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Girard and Representative Cannon.
I'll make a quick point, Chair. I think perhaps you and this committee might look at addressing some of Mark's concerns that he's brought up with some possible legislation in the next session. This committee would be a good place to do it.
Absolutely. I also was thinking the Consumer and Business Serves, Affairs Committee. I don't know if you're working with them, but we will make recommendations. I just made a note to my committee staff to talk to their committee staff. Some of it is more appropriate for my committee, some of it's going to be more appropriate there, but absolutely. Thank you for that suggestion. Representative Cannon.
Madam Chair, just a comment. Maybe it's a question. Neil, you said something. You suggested that from the standpoint of contamination, gray and black water may be sort of indistinguishable, or at least not distinguished by much. It's sort of hard for me to believe that just from, you know, a living in my home standpoint. It's also hard to believe that other states would have would treat them differently and would allow the reuse of gray water for instance, broader purposes than we do in Oregon, if that was in fact the case, or if there weren't some readily available kind of off-the-shelf technologies to make the gray water, the stuff I'm putting down my shower drain or my kitchen sink, up to snuff. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, you're exactly right. I mean, obviously, when you look at it, black water has more things in it than you would think would be in gray water from a shower or a sink. But in different households, if you have children, you have different things going on that you might be rinsing, washing out in sinks and that type of thing. So in terms of fecal contamination bacteria, you wind up having a lot of the same fecal contamination that are in sinks as you might actually have in a toilet situation. But in the other states, what the states have done is they have gone through a process of looking at that, and in their management practices for gray water, they actually have advice as to how to use or how to manage that water so you don't have problems from that. And I think that's what we're talking about, is that our current rules for the individual residential home prohibit us from actually using the gray water in that situation. But if we had legislation that would change that so that we can actually put together management practices that people could use, and whether that would be some treatment beforehand, and how you would use the water, where you would put it, would you put it out in the ground in terms of a flood irrigation system, drip irrigation system? In most of the states that I've looked at, they don't allow spraying of that gray water, so you don't want to aerosolize it, so you can increase some potential in terms of risk to people and human health. And so they go through that process of just evaluating what you can and can't do and how to manage it so you don't have those contaminants getting out.
I appreciate that clarification. information, and I certainly hope that we will also be undertaking that process.
Any other questions? Okay, before you go, first of all, I want to thank all of you for coming here today and providing the update. But I am going to ask you if, because we've got basically all the brains that can solve this problem right here at this panel, and I'm going to ask all of you to work together. They're all pointing at each other up here. Work together and come back to this committee in October with a recommendation, whether it's, looking at rule changes, legislation, certainly for some of the things that you've identified, Mark, as Representative Garrard suggested.
Sure.
Come back and present. I'm hoping that 2 months will give you enough time to work through this, come up with recommendations for this committee on how we can move forward and resolve this. It sounds like, other states are doing it and been able to work successfully through it, so certainly we're not reinventing the wheel here. So I appreciate all the work that you've done, and I look forward to hearing back from you in a couple months. And my ABLE committee staff, Beth Petrino, will be working with you to coordinate that.
Great. Okay.
Thank you. Gail, I know you're up. We're going to switch the agenda to allow Gail to run off to another meeting, and she's going to talk about PBDEs, flame retardants, and provide us an update. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Environmental Public Health Administrator for Department of Human Services Public Health Division. You are about to be handed out a report that was required under Senate Bill 962 in the 2005 regular session, which Representative Garrard was a co-sponsor on, that included brominated flame retardants in the definition of hazardous substance under ORS 453. It also prohibited the introduction or delivery for introduction into commerce for products that contained two of at least the three different types of brominated flame retardants, and then it required the Department of Human Services to issue a single report regarding brominated flame retardants. And so this report, although it was completed earlier this year, it was mostly a matter of scheduling with your busy agendas between then and now, that we wanted to officially submit this to the committee, as I believe the statute requires us to submit this to a committee, appropriate interim committee with jurisdiction over natural resources matters. So I won't necessarily take up time to go into the larger issue for you. I do want to call your attention to just a couple things in here, if I might. One is that, and this specifically focused on DECA brominated biphenyl ethers, and there was a lot of discussion during the 2005 session about Penta versus Octa versus the DECA, and they are just what their names seem to indicate in terms of the molecular structure. We use a lot of decabrominated biphenyl ethers in the United States. In fact, almost half of the worldwide use is used here in the U.S. A lot of discussion about the concerns of any type of chemicals seem to revolve around PBTs. How persistent is it? How bioaccumulative is it? How toxic is it? And so this report kind of walks through, as the statute required us to do, is to review the current state of the science or the state of the scientific literature, which necessarily has to be a little slower than the science itself by the time you get through writing it and peer reviewing it and publishing it and so on. Let me say a couple things. One, the DECA, first in 2005, we prohibited the Penta and the Octa from being in commerce. That left the DECA. And there was a lot of discussion then about, well, are we ready to ban it, or are there other alternatives? How bad is it, et cetera? And so that's what this report attempts to capture. It is a very persistent compound. It is a low to moderate, has low to moderate bioaccumulative attributes, and it is frankly of undetermined toxicity. On page 5 of the report, it indicates that according to, it does not meet the threshold according to the studies that have been done, and there the table identifies two trademarked products that were tested on laboratory animals through a couple different exposure routes. It does not meet the criteria under Oregon statute of highly toxic chemicals, but frankly, the Oregon statute does not get at chronic exposures. It really was only designed to and attempts to deal with highly toxic acute exposures, which is a whole different issue. There is new scientific research that indicates that DECA is an endocrine disruptor and also interferes with the nervous system. And in terms of part of the challenge of this particular issue on this particular substance is that this is such a moving target. The science is moving and consistently so. And so, frankly, even between the beginning of this year when this report was completed and today, there have been more things done and more things are under review now. A couple things from the U.S. EPA. One is that they have literally just a couple weeks ago now have put out a toxicology assessment. We frankly have not had any opportunity to really go through that and take a look at that in terms of any new information. They had also, EPA had also considered issuing a new rule around use of the DECA. They have put that on the back shelf and are waiting for the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which earlier this year said that they were going, CPSC was going to look at household furniture coverings and non-chemical alternatives. And so EPA is deferring to the Consumer Product Safety Commission to do its thing. I know this may be shocking to some, but sometime they figure by January of next year that EPA will come out with some new reports and some new information. I want to also draw your attention on page 7 of the report. The disposal of these kinds of products, and they are used in everything from circuit board manufacturing to household carpet cushions to draperies to seat cushions and so on. There is some concern about PBDEs being released from electronics recycling facilities, automotive shredding, metal recycling facilities. From a population standpoint, of course, the occupational exposure would necessarily be higher than for others. In landfills, PBDEs can leach out and leachate, and incineration is also an issue. So in general, we want to call your attention to the fact that this continues to be an ongoing issue. There is just an awful lot more information, frankly, that needs to, that we have identified in the report. Biomonitoring in terms of exposure to humans would be one particular piece. And I can't let this occasion go without saying that we would encourage the legislature to consider looking at reforming chemicals policy overall rather than dealing with one chemical compound versus another. TSCA, which is the Federal Toxic Substances Control Act, covers only, frankly, a small fraction of the chemicals that are out there. And so if we've got 80,000 chemicals, you can see that this would be a pretty significant chunk of work that perhaps there's a different way of approaching that. So I wanted to commend this report to you for your consideration in the 09 session.
Thank you, Gail. Appreciate you staying and providing that. Any questions for Gail? Okay. Thank you. We'll see you next time, I'm sure. Okay. Next up is Michael Campagna, who's the director of the Oregon State University Institute for Water and Watersheds. He's going to talk about this water roundtables that I've been working with him and the Institute on, and we'll provide an overview on that. Thank you. Do you have a PowerPoint? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, Susan's passing out just a one-pager. No PowerPoint today.
And for the record, just state your
name. Yes. Michael Campana, Director of Oregon State University's Institute for Water and Watersheds, and Madam Chair, Vice Chairs Burley and Cannon, members of the committee and their guests, thanks for inviting me here today, and I won't take a long time since I'm flat out of quarters. Anyway, as Madam Chair mentioned, this concept of Oregon water roundtables actually originated with her, and the, if you will, the implementing agencies or organizations are the Institute for Water and Watersheds, the Institute for Natural Resources, which is an Oregon University System entity, and also Oregon Sea Grant Extension will be working on this. And I'm not going to go into the importance of water. We wouldn't all be here if we didn't know that. But I think an apropos quote is one from former Representative Wayne Aspinall, who said, "In the West, when you touch water, you touch everything." And that's, I think, been amply demonstrated by the speakers before me. What we are proposing to do is, starting in about 2 months, in late September and running for about a month, is to conduct a series of roundtable discussions throughout the state. These will not be meetings. We don't like to use that term because a meeting implies something that we sort of have today, where you're on that side and I'm on this side. But essentially, we want to conduct roundtable discussions, forums in various parts of the state. And basically, what we want to do is to receive input and develop information that will inform efforts to identify and communicate a vision and to figure out where Oregon is, where Oregon is going, and where Oregonians want to be with respect to adaptive, integrated, and sustainable water management. Now, those are fancy words, but basically we're conducting listening sessions. We want to find out what Oregonians are thinking about water, what they view the problems are, and what they imagine as some of the solutions might be. We've identified five locations where we'll hold these roundtables: Ontario, Newport, Bend, Medford, and Salem. And we have not scheduled these yet, and in the next day or so, I'll be getting together with Chair Dingfelder and actually talk about some of these dates. But we'd actually, one of the dates has sort of been set. You folks are going to be meeting in Bend on the 25th of September. We'd actually like to hold the one in 26th. We'd like to actually hold the one in Bend maybe the day after or something like that. Now, what's the agenda of these roundtables going to be? And again, I'm simply reading from this two-page or two-sided sheet I sent out. There are a lot of things on people's minds, and so what we are planning to do is, in the first part of the roundtable, have local experts, not people necessarily from out of state or Portland or Salem, except as required, talk about some of the issues particular to that area. And so we're going to be relying on local people in a particular area to help us identify what those issues are and what the presentations should entail. And then after providing, and these will be informational presentations, and then after that, we're going to form breakout groups and with facilitators, and this is where groups like Oregon Sea Grant Extension come in, we are going to try to elicit from the people there what's on their mind, what they see the problems are, what they see the water future as being, and how that future is essentially tied to their economic and social well-being. We've listed in some of the, at the bottom of the first page there, we've listed some of these topics that came off the tops of maybe 15 or 20 people's heads. They are not all-inclusive, and obviously in some areas, some of those topics are going to be at the top of the list, and some may be at the bottom of the list. So insofar as possible, we don't want to drive these roundtables. It's not about me or it's not about the chair. It's about what folks are thinking. Another important thing that I want to mention is with respect to how we elicit opinions from people, obviously when we plan these, not everybody who wants to go is going to be able to go to one. So we are actually working with Sea Grant Extension to develop a means so that we can get input from people who maybe can't take off from work, or some people who may show up but are perhaps a little bit reticent about talking about certain things in public. So we want to design some mechanisms so that we can get a good sampling of opinion so that you don't necessarily have to be there and participate in these things, because otherwise then the opinions that we get will simply be a function of the people who showed up and opened their mouths. So we don't want to do that. I also want to mention that this exercise will not produce a water plan or a water strategy for the state of Oregon. What it will provide is information to the people who want to use it, such as the legislature, the governor, Oregon Water Resources Commission. So we are not going to come out of this with a water plan. In fact, we hope that perhaps some of the people who show up will have an idea about, look, this is what we'd like to do here, and we're already moving ahead on this, and we'd like state support or something like that. And so basically the outcome of this will not be a water plan, but it's going to be that overused term, a white paper, that we will produce. We will also have the raw data available, for example, who showed up and some of the opinions and things like that. And that white paper will be available to anyone who wants it. We'll put it up on our website. We'll distribute it to the, obviously, the legislature, Water Resources Commission, governor's office. And we've also, some of us are also committed to preparing the inevitable PowerPoint presentation, which is sorely lacking today. And we'll go around to speak to groups, whoever invites us and wants to hear about it. We're not going to essentially say, look, we're coming to your town Tuesday, you got to show up. No. If we're invited, we'll show up and we'll explain what we found out. So I just want to emphasize that this is not a water plan. It's simply an exercise to gather information to inform those who might want to develop a water plan. So I think with that, I'd be happy to take questions from you.
Great. Thank you, Michael. And I just wanted to say to committee members, I serve on the board of the Institute for Water and Watersheds, along with there's several people in the audience that also do. And there was a lot of input on this proposal. One thing, as Michael mentioned, you know, I think you've heard me talk about this. We are one of two states in the West that does not have a comprehensive integrated water resource management plan. There has not been, at least in the 15 years I've been in Oregon, any type of sort of statewide discussions or dialogues with the people of Oregon about the future of Oregon's water resources, except in, you know, there's been a lot of discussions in certain areas of the state around specific issues. As we know, in one part of the state, there's probably been more discussions than we can shake a stick at. But the intent is really just to help inform us and decision makers and policy makers about what the pulse, interests, concerns, vision from Oregon citizens about the future of our water. I think it's a dialogue that needs to happen. As you hear, we're doing a data gathering exercise. That's very specific to talking to municipal irrigators, engineers. It's not really engaging the public. The other is, I think that as the governor is looking at developing a water strategy, this will hopefully help inform their efforts as well. And I want to emphasize the word integrated. We've heard today from the Water Resources Department and a little bit from the DEQ. We haven't heard from ODF&W, and they play a big role in looking at in-stream water rights and how to protect in-stream water rights for fish and wildlife. So I'm going to encourage folks, if on my committee, if you happen to be interested, I certainly encourage you to attend one of these. We'll get dates out as soon as possible. And again, there is not an end product of legislation or specific, you know, funding mechanisms. It's really to help inform us. And we've had a lot of discussions in this committee about issues, but we don't engage in a broader level. Folks who work on the ground, for instance, watershed councils, soil and water conservation some districts, lots of landowners who are involved in these issues every day, they don't get a chance to come to Salem and necessarily tell us what they think. We hear about it in our own districts. But I certainly am looking forward to going around the state and hearing what folks have to say. So appreciate your hard work on this and the folks who have been working to put this together. Representative Grove.
Just a quick question, Madam Chair. And those items you pointed out are correct. And, Michael, that's kind of... We chastise the state of Oregon because we don't have a plan, but we don't even have our state water adjudication completed yet. And it would be impossible to complete a plan until your water adjudication has been settled. Would you agree with that?
No.
Switch.
I think, okay. There goes our pop down the drain. Yeah, I'm sorry. I think one of the important elements of a plan is knowing how much water you have. Okay. Certainly, you need to know. The adjudication essentially answers the question, who has how much or who has what and when can they use it? But I think if we wait until all the water is adjudicated, then
about 20 years.
We're not going to have a plan. And let me. You're probably wondering where did this guy come from? In my previous life,
you gave me your card before the meeting. Or
that's right. No, but I mean before that. So it is possible. There are actually some states in the West that if you think Oregon hasn't adjudicated, that are perhaps maybe 50 or 75 years away from adjudicating and have developed a plan, and I was involved in one of these, and that was New Mexico, where they are still trying to figure out who owns what, but they needed a plan, and this is something that I'm big on, although people in Oregon perhaps have a little different viewpoint, is the one reason New Mexico developed a plan was because they were essentially told by the Supreme Court of the U.S. that they couldn't keep other states from using their water if they had no plan to use it. So they figured out, I guess we better come up with a plan. And the adjudication is ongoing, and that, of course, is integrated into the plan as the various regions of the state are adjudicated. And that's what I envision here. I don't like to use the word plan anymore because plan implies the first thing people think is someone's going to take my water. I'd rather use something like strategy or vision, but you sort of need to know what you have and where you're going. And then as the adjudication falls into place, that has to be integrated into the plan. So the plan's got to be a living, you know, a dynamic thing. So I didn't mean to be flip with you, Representative Girard. You made a very good point. If we haven't adjudicated things, how can we plan? So
thank you. I appreciate an honest response.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Well, we'll look forward to working with you. We'll make sure and get those dates out. I've already been talking to several members of the committee about it, and look forward to the information that will come out of that. Thanks so much.
Sure.
And we are going to switch around I'm going to give a very brief update on the groundwater wells, but I'm exempt groundwater well issue. We are going to have the climate change update from David Vantoff up next because he's calling in. He's actually in San Diego at the Western Climate Initiative right now. And then last up, we'll have the peak oil report from the city of Portland. Just real briefly, exempt groundwater wells. For those of you who are on the committee last session, I know you think back fondly on those discussions on the exempt groundwater wells. And fear not, that has not dropped off the face of the earth. I am working with the Oregon Policy Consensus Center on a facilitated process, working with many of the stakeholders who were involved in that last session. We actually are having the second meeting today, so some of the folks here today are all going to be moving down to Wilsonville for that meeting in the afternoon. And I just wanted to let you know that that process is ongoing, and we'll be providing the committee with updates as we move forward. So look forward to providing you, hopefully by next, our September meeting, we'll have had already two meetings under our belt. But we already had our first meeting, laid out a whole series of issues that needed to be addressed. We handed a bunch of questions to the Water Resources Department that they're working on. We're going to hear from them today to help set the stage for future discussions. And if you're interested in attending any of those meetings, certainly they're open. I encourage you to come. I know you have more meetings than you can possibly attend, but if this is something that you're interested, just let Beth know and she'll make sure you get the meeting dates. Okay, with that, I think we're going to call David Vantoff, who's in sunny San Diego, I'm sure, and get an update on the Western Climate Initiative.
You receive Vantoff. I can't.
Okay. I think we'll call him and let him know that we're waiting for him. And then with that, I'll bring up Susan Anderson, the Director of the Office of Sustainable Development for the City of Portland. She's going to provide us an update on their peak oil report. And Martha, you can come up as well. We'll try to locate, he, you know, is probably outside at the beach.
No, he's surfing or something.
Yeah. It's actually quite nice.
Do you know how to bring this up, Ian?
Okay, we'll get help with that, Susan. Why don't you get started just in the interest of time? Could you please make sure and identify yourself for the record?
Sure. There we go. Morning.
Morning.
Make sure everybody's up here. Last thing before lunch. I'm Susan Anderson. I'm the director of the Office of Sustainable Development with the City of Portland. For those of you that don't know about our office, we were created 8 years ago. We are sort of a hybrid for city government. About 30 or 40% of our budget comes from partnerships with businesses, grants, foundations, and other partnerships. We provide a broad array of technical and financial services on energy and environmental issues and policy issues. And if you live in Portland, we're also in charge of garbage collection, in case you want to know who to complain to. I'm here to talk about volatile oil prices and natural gas prices and supply and the issue of peak oil. When we thought about this 2 or 3 years ago, a lot of people said, oh, peak oil's not real. This doesn't matter. Why are we talking about this? Now you can just go to fill up your car and you know that whether or not peak oil is real, you know that it is already having a real impact in Portland and throughout the state and throughout the U.S. Last year, Portland City Council took a major step forward on two policies related to energy use and peak oil and global warming. First, they made a commitment to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. And second, they passed a resolution to reduce fossil fuel use by 50% within 25 years. To jump into the discussion of these two policies and these two goals and understand how they're related, I need to give you a little bit of history. Back in 1979, when those of us who were around were actually putting on sweaters and talking about Jimmy Carter and all the things about energy policy, Portland actually adopted a local energy policy at that time. In 1993, we adopted our first local action plan on global warming, looking at reducing emissions throughout residential, commercial, transportation, and industrial. 8 years later, in 2001, there you go.
A little technical difficulties with this, but why don't you keep going? We'll get it sorted out.
You got the story. So we adopted these policies related to climate change and global warming, and what's important about this is what's happened since 1990. Since 1990, in the U.S., emissions have only gone in one direction. They've gone up about 16%. In Oregon, emissions have gone up about... Well, that's not working either, but that's all right. emissions have gone up by almost 20% in Oregon. In Portland, Multnomah County, emissions are back to 1990 levels, and from a per capita point of view, emissions are actually down 16%. So some things are going different in Portland than they are in the rest of the state, and there's a lot of reasons why. Let me just run through a couple of examples, and I'm doing this because I want to give you some examples of the kinds of things you would do. You wouldn't have to care about the issue of global warming at all. You would merely have to care about our economy and in terms of having an impact on businesses and residents and on the price of oil. In terms of transportation in Multnomah County, since 1990, vehicle miles traveled are down 7%. Gasoline use is down 13%. This is from 1990 to 2006. We know that the numbers have only gone up, especially in the past year, as gasoline prices have increased to $4 a gallon. Transit ridership is up 85%. If you've been in town, we have free transit downtown. 5% of all work trips are now by bike, compared to about 1% nationally. In city government, again, council didn't have to care about environmental issues or global warming, but they did care about their own budget. We have now cut our energy bills by about 25%, saving about $3 million a year. Average electricity use in Portland households is down about 5% as our homes get larger and larger. This is all through partnerships with electric utilities, with the Energy Trust of Oregon, and in on the business side, because of the business energy tax credit. We also have more than 150 LEED, which is Leadership for Energy and Environmental Design, green building certified projects either completed or underway in the metro area, making us a leader nationally. In terms of renewable resources, we will be using 100% renewable power for city government building and facilities by 2010. We're in the midst of working with private developers to develop 2 megawatts of solar on city facilities, and the county is doing another 2 megawatts. For those of you who have wastewater plants in your community, we have just finished a 1.6 megawatt generation facility that'll generate out of waste sewer gas about $700,000 worth of power a year that can all be used on site. We currently run all of our city and county diesel vehicles on biodiesel, B50 to B99. We actually did this from an economic development point of view, again, not from an energy or environmental point of view. We put out a request for proposals to farmers in Oregon and said, we want someone to grow our fuel for use in the city. We have then since actually have a contract directly with a farmer in eastern Oregon to grow the canola that then is turned into the biofuels. And so we have between 50% and 99% biodiesel running in our vehicles. So we did all this work predominantly over the past 15 years now related to the issue of global warming. If you ask anybody why they took these actions, they, 99% of them won't talk about global warming. They won't talk about the environment. They'll talk about creating a more livable community, and they'll talk about saving money for their own business or for their own family. Things have changed since then in terms of the gravity of the issue. People understand that peak oil or the issue of volatile oil supplies and prices is very real, and we understand that because we experience it on a daily basis. We're, from an economic development point of view, we're losing millions of dollars from our economy every year. Oregon imports 100% of its petroleum and has no refineries. We import 100% of our natural gas. And in Portland and Multnomah County, 80% of our building energy use is from fossil fuels. So we think we're based on hydro, and that's true for electricity for a lot of parts of Oregon, but not true for the metro area because our power comes from Portland General Electric and Pacific, and more than 50% of that electricity is generated from fossil fuels. So we're losing a lot of money, and we're polluting a lot. In addition, the amount of money lost is increasing rapidly. We spent $1.1 billion on electricity, natural gas, and transportation fuels in 2004. In just 3 years, that went from $1.1 billion to $1.6 billion in 2007. That's $500 million more. And we know that the number for 2008 is going to be close to $2 billion. And nearly all of that money left our local economy. So here's what we did about a year and a half ago. We began to look at this issue predominantly from a social point of view. Is what is the impact of these rising prices going to have on our local economy and on people in our community? We created a task force that had a good array of technical professionals, lawyers, educators, policy people, and interested citizens. The groups met more than 40 meetings on a lot of various issues. How do we keep public services running? What's the impact of local food and agriculture, and how can that help in terms of reducing food prices for people, the economy, and land use and transportation? We came up with a comprehensive list of different kinds of things, and those are in the executive summary that I've handed out there. I won't run through all the recommendations. You can read through some of them here, and you can read through the report. But the key focus was on how do we keep public services running? How do we help lower-income and vulnerable families have access to reasonably priced food, heat, electricity, and transportation? There's a lot of focus on the connection between transportation, land use, housing, and energy, and how those things are all connected, and also a lot of connection between the potential for job creation and opportunities as we design our communities to use less energy and less waste. So the council adopted the peak oil report in March 2007. After the report was adopted, they also began to do many other things. The first was that they established the goal to reduce fossil fuel use within 25 years by 50%. They also chose peak oil as one of five major trends that will shape Portland's future for development as we move forward in our comprehensive planning. They directed my office to develop a new high-performance building policy, which will be out for review next month, and they allocated $1.4 million in this year's budget to work on energy-related issues. Here's a list of some of the things that they're funding this year, focused on transportation, renewable energy, local food, green building, and economic development efforts related to promoting clean energy industries. So here's the point of me coming today. This is more as you move forward on the issue of how does the state react to and hopefully plan ahead for issues related to volatile supplies of energy and volatile prices. I think we've learned a couple of things. One of the things we've learned is that the whole discussion is really volatile. People have really strong opinions about it. People will have very strong opinions about whether we've reached sort of this peak in terms of production. One of the first ground rules we had for the task force was that no one's allowed to talk about whether or not peak oil has actually occurred, because we decided it really didn't matter whether it was 2 years ago or 10 years in the future. We know that prices are rising quickly now, and people are already hurting, so we need to move on this issue. So by removing that from the discussion as you move forward, you get people to focus on actually helping to solve the problem. We also decided to integrate the peak oil work with recommendations related to global warming and climate protection. And by combining those two goals together, we began to look more closely at issues of food security and public safety, land use and transportation, and how to keep housing affordable. The third lesson learned and recommendation is that it's essential that businesses and political leaders like yourselves understand just how huge of an economic drain it is to spend so much money on oil and natural gas. In Portland, it was $1.6 billion for 2007. We know it's going to be close to $2 billion for 2008. The fourth lesson in all of this is that in the midst of all sort of this calamity, we actually have a huge economic opportunity. In Portland, we have hundreds of businesses that have figured out that there's money to be made. There's money to be made in energy efficiency, in green building, and in renewable energy, and that there's a huge demand for these technologies and products and services here in Oregon, but also as an export to other places, to the nation to the south of us, California, where many of my friends who were in firms, architecture firms with 20 or 30 people now have 80 people, and they're all working in California and in China. And so there's some great opportunities to do the things that we've learned how to do well over the past 5 to 10 years and export our knowledge and our technologies. One thing I think that we know for sure is that the states and cities that embrace sustainable development and understand these issues are going to be the winners. They will have more money circulating in their local economy, and they will also be the ones that get to sell the technologies and the products and services to everybody else. So when we talk about peak oil and we talk about global warming as we move forward in this group, and I was on the governor's carbon allocation task force and the integration group, the original group on global warming, and I'm on the Oregon Sustainability Board, we are really trying to bring these issues together. And as much as climate change change is an enormously, you know, the most serious environmental issue of our time. It is also the greatest potential economic development structure for moving forward for Oregon. And I just think it's crucially important that we link those two things together. So there's my website if you'd like more information, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Susan. And actually, I'm going to ask the first question before I forget it, which is, since we heard from Mark Long and work with the DCBS and the different commissions to update their codes, mm-hmm. building codes, plumbing codes, electrical codes, you talked about what Portland is doing to expand your programs. Can you talk about, has there been any barriers that you found at the state level? As far as trying to improve or increase the codes for the
sure.
city?
In the past, so let's talk past, so I've been doing this for, you know, 25 years now or something, and the code was always an issue because we couldn't change code. And now there seems to be a door opening. So we're taking a two-pronged approach, which is one, we're working with our own building codes agency and working with a lot of technical people in town and with the state building codes agency to look at, is there an opportunity to have a more stringent code related to energy efficiency and green building in Portland? That could take a while. So we're moving forward on a more market-based approach, which is we're looking at a carbon rebate fee-bate, where in terms of for new construction of commercial buildings and potentially for homes, if you build a home just to code, you basically will have to pay a fee based on carbon emissions. If you build a code above home, if you build a home above code, a certain percentage, probably 25%, you won't have to pay the fee. And we have lots of examples of how to get to there for a very cost-effective way to get there. If you go 35%, we will actually pay you, taking money from those who aren't moving in the market to those who are, and be able to pay them a rebate for moving forward. So this is all being developed right now. We have home builders, we have developers, architects, engineers, real estate people all involved in developing it. And many people like this better than a code because it's market-based. It's a choice. You can pay the fee, or you can begin to learn how to move and do these new technologies.
And this would be for new construction?
This is for new construction. We have other ideas for existing, and as we move forward in the next about 3 weeks, we'll come out with a draft, and I'll make sure the committee gets a copy of the draft. It's you know, a different way of looking at it. It's market-based instead of saying these are just the rules. But over time, obviously, if we can move code, and that's what other places, Boston, other places have just done, have just moved their code to a more efficient code.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Questions? Representative Cannon?
Just a quick comment and then a question. Susan, thanks for your leadership and Portland's leadership on this issue. It's clear that a lot of the success that Portland has had related to emissions is the result of programs that work in an urban environment, probably not as transferable to some of them, at least to rural areas, or are only transferable with greater difficulty. And it helps reinforce my impression that as we continue to move forward on emissions reductions as a state, we're going to be looking to our urban areas, including Portland, to make the lion's share of those reductions. That was my comment. My question is somewhat different. There might be a generalized perception that the good work that Portland has done on this issue may come at the cost of creating a regulatory or tax environment that will deter economic development. You've cited some sort of counterexamples. Do you get complaints from Portland businesses, Portland residents, et cetera, about the regulatory or tax environment? My perception is there isn't a lot of complaint out there.
We never get complaints about business on anything. You know that. There's a lot of discussion about the idea that, you know, you want to encourage the things that you want to encourage and tax the things that you don't want, and that's like a whole school of thought. That aside, I think what we're seeing is a great interest in trying to do it in a voluntary way as long as we can. And so everything from waste reduction, recycling, green building, energy efficiency, putting funding into technical resources so people actually want to do the right thing. It's just really messy and hard to do it, whether it's at your home or in your business. And by trying to make those things easier to get done and providing incentives when possible. I think we've really moved the marketplace way more than most places in the country because the people want to do this stuff anyway. That said, of course, there's the worry that, and it's a lot of it's a little bit of rhetoric because you can go to the most conservative businesses and they will often be the ones who will tell you that they've saved money, you know, by investing in energy efficiency, for example. And I think basically how we do it is we get out of the discussion as much as possible and put the businesses out there who have made the changes and have seen the benefits and have them be the spokespeople for these kinds of things.
Thanks.
Representative Burley, and then we're going to have to move on to call. Sorry, Vantoff back.
He left?
We found him. He was at the beach or something. Kidding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Susan, one of the things, over the last few months I've been looking at efficiency, the question about why are we incenting more efficiency measures? We've got renewable portfolio standards. We're talking about WCI and cap and trade. And yet, for example, last year when we expanded the BETCY, the Business Energy Tax Credit, we were trying to get that tax credit applicable to investments in efficiency measures, and we couldn't quite get there. And yet a lot of people admit that efficiency, you get a bigger bang for your buck. And one of the things that I found in my readings in the last few months is that in the building sector, particularly with the codes, that the building industry, and this is obviously a gross generalization, but, you know, they tend to push back. And the reason that I read was that, you know, the cost of the efficiency measure is borne by the builder, yet the benefits, the dividends, are paid to the consumer, the person that buys the building, which is fine. But my question is, then, if that's a problem, how do we resolve that? How do we deal with that
disconnect,
or whatever you want to call it? I mean, I agree with where we're trying to go with this thing, but if we can identify and that's a real problem, how do we get around that? How do we address that?
I'll answer it twice or two ways. One is in a very specific example, multifamily buildings. So you own the building, Jackie's your renter, and she pays the bills, and so she has no incentive to make improvements because she might not live there next year, but you have no incentive to make the improvements because you're not paying the bills. So for a decade, we've worked actually statewide on promoting energy efficiency in multifamily. We did it by not talking about energy at all. We did it by talking about comfort, about talking about, you know, retention of renters, all the other things about why people make decisions. And the result has been about 40,000 apartment units weatherized in Portland. So there are ways to market about other things that people care about. On the bigger picture, we don't have time, from my perspective, to do one-offs building by building, trying to get them to make energy efficiency improvements and or to get the code right away. And so I think what we need to do is look at a much broader scale. We need codes that set the bar high, but we also need to have what I just call a big pile of money. And one of the things we're looking at in Portland right now is how can we use the ability of a local government or a state government to generate revenue, a lot of revenue. It's probably $250 million a year for 20 years just to weatherize all the houses in Portland. And sell revenue bonds to organizations who want to invest sort of patient capital, because these returns are very real, but you will never go invest in your house because it's 5% over 17 years, and that's really messy and it's not that big a deal, so people don't do it. But there are groups like PERS and a whole lot of other places that for 5% return over 7, they want to have a part of their portfolio like that. So what we're looking at right now is how to develop an energy investment fund where homeowners, where commercial buildings can actually get access to reasonable capital over a long term. And because the big problem is really this upfront capital. And so we're really working on how do we do that. The cities of, believe it or not, they're small cities like Berkeley, Palm Desert, California, and a handful of others have started to figure this out and are having people pay it back through their property tax. And when I sell my house, it just goes with the house. You know, and it's not a lot of money, but again, it's individual one decision after another. Most of the houses that are going to be here 50 years from now are already built right now. And so it's not just new construction. It's going back and trying to make all of these improvements, you know, one by one. So I think we have to get rid of that disconnect and make capital more available. So I think that's, you know, one of the main issues from developers I've talked to who are not leaders in terms of wanting to jump on this issue, but have this capital constraint. Being able to get capital at 4 or 5% would make a huge difference.
Thank you, Susan. I'm sorry to cut off this great discussion, but Dave, we called back, so we've missed him. But I appreciate your leadership.
Sure.
I know you've been working on this for a long, long time, and certainly appreciate all the good work that you've done. And we'll contact you about updates as you move forward, especially on the fee-based program.
Great.
Thanks so much. And just as Beth dialing, I will note that Brian Darity from WISPA, the Western States Petroleum Association, couldn't be here, but he has asked to submit a couple of letters, and I think those will be passed out to you and right now. And it's about the Peak Oil Task Force, as you can see. David.
Hello.
Hey, David. It's Representative Dingfelder here. I'm sorry we're a little late. We ran over on Peak Oil.
No problem. You enabled us to get through a little mini earthquake here at the hotel, so thanks for the extra minute. Just a little rumble. That was enough to get everybody a little antsy.
Okay. Well, we're glad we're not in California. But anyway, unfortunately, we only have a few minutes left because we've run over. I'm glad you're safe. Are you outside right now?
No, I'm in a meeting room.
Okay. But so we have about 5 minutes. I'm hoping you can provide us with an update. I know you're in San Diego right now at the Western Climate Initiative meeting, and we'll take a few minutes afterwards for questions. So it's all yours, David. And
great,
for the record, make sure and state your name.
Yeah, for the record, Dave Antoff from the Governor's Office. Thank you, Madam Chair. The highlights of just a quick check-in would be that the WCI released a draft design document 2 weeks ago that proposes to how we're going to recommend to our respective jurisdictions to move forward on the cap and trade program. The document still has some you know, I would say major the big level holes that we need to fill between now and September when the final design document is proposed to come out, and as well as lots of detail that needs to be worked on both between now and September, but then also beyond September on some of the issues such as offsets and protocols around how to include forestry and agriculture in the offset programs as the document recommends at this point. So right now I'm at the stakeholder meeting, the regional stakeholder meeting in San Diego to get feedback on this draft design document. It's very well attended. I think we've got around 500 or so in attendance and on the webinar. And today's devoted to stakeholder feedback, and then the WCI partners will meet the next 2 days to work through next steps in terms of some of the pieces that need to get folded into the document. Some of the highlights in terms of the document, I think as I've talked to you before about transportation and home heating fuels is now recommended to be included in the program, although in a second compliance phase, so not until 2015, with the start of the program being 2012 for stationary source and electricity process emissions. So with the include when transportation and fuels and home heating fuels are included in the program, that gets up to around 90% of the economy-wide emissions being covered in the program. So it's gotten to be really comprehensive in scope in terms of the amount of coverage in the program. That was one of the goals initially, was to be as broad and economy-wide as possible within kind of the limitations of the systems that we're trying to put in place. Also of note, Ontario has joined the WCI as the most recent partner. With Ontario and Quebec and the other British Columbia and Manitoba, that now roughly 75 to 80% of the Canadian emissions and economy are included in the WCI initiative. I think we're around 20% of the U.S. Economy and emissions with the existing states that are partners to the program. So that's, you know, expanded as well and is very international in scope at this point. A couple of the things that offsets are, we got to a little bit more level of detail in the design document, how offsets would be integrated into the program. One is the clear support for offsets from the jurisdictions. The current draft document recommends that up to 10% of an entity's compliance obligations could be covered through offsets. And I can touch on that if there's questions, which results in a fairly significant amount of, very significant amount of overall reductions being available through the offsets. System. And as some of you probably have been following, offsets are one of the cost containment mechanisms that we can design into the program, because offsets coming from outside of the cap sector in theory are going to be less expensive than allowances, and so it brings down the allowance price for the program overall. The major place that the document doesn't have answers yet for is how to apportion the allowances among the states. That's a crucial issue that we're trying to work through. It's the, you know, the most difficult one, because that's where the value in the system is, and there's varying perspectives from the varying jurisdictions about, you know, who should get what and how to come up with a fair and equitable methodology that doesn't kind of disproportionately advantage or disadvantage any of the individual jurisdictions. And so that's a challenge we're working through and hope to have methodology completed by the September document, if not some recommendations in terms of the apportionment among the jurisdictions of the actual allowance numbers. So that's kind of a real quick overview. I can touch on anything if folks have any follow-up questions or comments on, but I think I'll stop there since given the charge of time to cover it.
Okay, thanks, David. We'll take a couple of questions before we wrap up. Any questions for David right now? So, David, you said September is going to be, there's going to be the release of that. That's the final report?
Yeah, the final recommendations from the partners will be issued on in September to be sent to our governors and premiers.
Okay, because what we're probably going to want to do is have you come back in September and give an update with that report. We'll be in Bend in September, and I'll have you coordinate with Beth on that.
Okay, that sounds good.
I'm sure there'll be a lot more input by then when that final report recommendation comes out. All right, well, I'm glad you survived the earthquake. Thank you for persevering. We apologize for being late, and we'll be in touch soon. Thanks, David.
Okay, great. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to the committee.
Okay, thank you. And with just a reminder to committee members that our next hearing will be in Bend on September 26th. We'll be having a renewable energy. We'll have a broader discussion on climate change, and then we'll also probably have some updates on water, and there will be tours that we'll be setting up following that. So plan on spending the 26th in Bend, and we'll be putting together some type of dinner with the committee either the night before or that evening. So certainly, if you can mark your calendars, and Beth will be sending out that agenda soon. With that, I really appreciate everybody attending today and your attention, and we will adjourn the House Energy. Jonathan, I think we're going to have you go first because you're also a member of the plumbing board. Appreciate you being here. today. And again, just make sure and identify yourself for the record. And I do want to say that I think we have a number of people here that have been working on their own time to try to resolve the issue around gray water. As you heard, Judy from the DEQ talked about all the work that's been done at DEQ to look at the use of effluent, or that's water coming out of a pipe from wastewater treatment plant. She talked about the part that wasn't covered by the task force, and that's, if you want to think about it, it's what's created inside of the house, everything except what's basically being flushed down the toilet, and that's considered gray water. I know this is a really sexy